Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to American Statesman Blog Talk Radio, the place where it's all about duty, honor, country, and one nation under God. Today is Monday, June 17th, 2024. And, gosh, I love my country. It's my government I'm afraid of. And with that being said, we will get started here with the American Creed. I believe in the United States of America as a government of the people, by the people, for the people, whose just powers are derived from the consent of the governed, a democracy and a republic, a sovereign nation of many sovereign states, a perfect union, one and inseparable, established upon the principles of freedom, equality, justice, and humanity, for which American patriots sacrificed their lives and fortunes. I therefore believe it is my duty to my country to love it, to support its constitution, to obey its laws, to respect its flag, and to defend it against all enemies. William Tyler Page. And that's the way I feel about it. I don't know about you, but that's the way I feel. Now, tonight, we're going to be continuing on from last week. Those of you who were listening last week, we had two plus hours of discussion in reference to the Middle East and the history of the Middle East, how it impacts us, and those types of things. And Sarge was giving us his presentation, and he's going to continue tonight. I don't see him out there yet, but hopefully he will join us momentarily and go over it. And then he'll give this information, and then we'll stop and have a discussion about it. I think that might be Sarge out there now. Let's see if he pushes that button so I can tell for sure. Okay. The other thing, just some very quick updates before we get into all of that. it is so, so pathetic to watch this president. I'm sure many of you saw the parachuters and skydivers, and then he's walking the other way. He has no clue what's going on. He is totally lost, totally, totally lost. And the world is looking. It's like, God, this is the leader of the free world who can't find his way out of a paper bag. It's just very, very scary. And then what do we hear somewhere along the past week? Joe Biden. This election is not about age. This election has nothing to do with age. Well, there is not strictly age, but the age is a big part of it. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then, you know, all the garbage that's gone on with the NDA, the non-disclosure agreement with Trump, and all this other stuff and what they're trying to say. And it was a committee meeting. I'm not even sure what committee meeting it was, but it was Representative Massey was out there talking about the injustice. He said, you know, here's what the president, what Trump did, using his own money for his own NDA and whatever else, and had nothing to do with his campaign. But so, but just the hypocrisy of it all, and this is not an exact quote or anything, but he goes in to say, we have tax dollars, we have a slush fund for NDA money to pay out for people in this Congress. He said, and there's probably some of you here right now, you over there, maybe some on this side, who have taken advantage of that slush fund, taxpayer dollars, to pay for silencing somebody. And, I mean, he repeated that several times. And he was somewhat grinning as he said it. It's like, and like, okay, I wonder who was there who really is, who is doing that. There had to be, you just kind of had this feeling he knew several people on that committee, sitting on that committee, were the ones doing this. How much of tax dollars, our tax dollars, going to pay for their hush money for their misbehavior? I mean, it's so disgusting. And this is why we have such a corrupt government. So that's just one more example. This Congress is totally broken. We, you know, with the exception of just a few people, they all need to be fired. I know very few, and I would be happy to fire everybody if that would help clean up the process. So that's that's a mess. And that, now, just if you haven't seen that with Representative Massey, you ought to go out there and take a look. And then Matt Gaetz, he was on the Touchpoint Action convention thing this weekend, and he just blatantly, openly says, we have a corrupt government. This is what these people do. We've got to get rid of these people and whatever else. So, and it's so true. So true. Need to get rid of them as well. It's just so disgusting. Let's see. What is it? Today is the 17th, so we've got, what, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks till Independence Day. So I'm just hoping everybody here listening will promise me they will not say Happy July 4th. We are not celebrating a day on a calendar. And they would say Happy Independence Day. That's what July 4th is about. It's about independence, when we declared our independence. It's not about the calendar day. They've marginalized in what the event is, and they've played games by making it, well, it's just about going out and having a barbecue on July 4th. Happy July 4th. Totally forgetting what the true intent and the meaning of the holiday is. So please promise me you will not say Happy July 4th. Unless you go around and say Merry December 25th and Happy November 26th, 27th, whatever it may be that year kind of thing. I mean, if you go around saying everything is by a date, then okay, fine. But that is, if you don't say Merry December 25th, don't say Happy July 4th, okay? Let's remember what the day is for, Independence Day. And let's see, just an FYI, no show next week. I think I mentioned that last week. I'm going to be out of town on some business. No show next week. I hope to get back in time for the following week, but there is actually a chance to no shows for 2 weeks. But for right now, we're just saying no show next week. And then I think I actually mentioned this last week, but just in case I didn't, it doesn't hurt to repeat this one twice. It was this past week or two that the Supreme Court made their ruling on state banking. The states do have the right, constitutional right, to create their own banking outside of the Federal Reserve and to also set up their own currency. We have that right. And this is what people need to be encouraging their state legislatures to be doing. Yeah, this is what we need to do. We can, there's been so many attempts to shut down the Fed, and Mike Lee out of Utah, and I think it was Rand Paul, whoever, Chip Roy, were out there trying to shut down the Fed the old-fashioned way. But we can shut them down the other way. We can just not use them. If you don't want the central bank, digital currency mess, and all that other stuff, which is all part of the central banking system that Jefferson warned us about, We can bypass them and have a state bank. We can have our own currency at our state level and all that stuff. So this is what the states all need to do. You need to contact your governor, your legislature, the attorney generals for your states, all these people who would be engaged in setting up this banking system and making sure you have, and there are state banks in other places. State banks aren't new. The role that they have played with the Federal Reserve in the past is what we need to change. We need to cut the umbilical cord of the Federal Reserve. We need to sink them. We can sink them by making them go bankrupt. Well, there are ways to do this if we take control ourselves. So please keep an eye on that one and think about the benefits of not having a Federal Reserve and having state banking. So keep that in mind. And I know I'm probably making that a little bit simpler when you think about a state currency and then, it's making sure that it's acceptable in all the other states and whatever else, those kind of things. So it's not simple, it's not that easy, but it's definitely possible. And with the people who know what they know about banking and everything else, it's very feasible to do it, and that's what we should do. Okay, and now with that being said, we are going to go ahead. I have the chat room open if anybody wants to join out there. I see a couple of people out there. And you're more than welcome to post comments out there. I see Sarge is out there, and I see Sarge is ready to go. So if you want, as we're talking about this, Sarge is going over the history of the Middle East, you're more than welcome to post any questions or comments out there. Last week there was somebody trying to be funny and putting stupid and insulting remarks out there. And if the profanity and whatever else and nonsense is out there, I will delete stuff that just doesn't serve any purpose. I want useful conversation, not nonsense out there, not garbage. And so some want to call it censorship. I just want an intelligent, civil discussion. And if you're putting stuff out there that doesn't rate that way, then I don't see any purpose, and I really don't have any use for it. And I don't want it to be part of this show. So just try having some consideration for others and that type of thing. And let's be grown-ups in the room. Let's have a discussion. The fact of the matter is the Middle East has always been in turmoil, which something to do with association. Literally just heard it before the show, and if anybody has any more info, we can go into it. Something about the deal that Biden, Hunter Biden, was going to be on some board which had money out of Ukraine and all this other, and he somehow, some way, the way they were conniving this deal, Hunter Biden was standing to get somewhere around $128 million and all this other stuff. And something happened along the way to pull the plug on it. Somebody spoke up and said something that wrong, whatever, and it pulled the plug on the whole deal, so they lost out on that one. But just imagine, after everything that's happened in this corrupt Biden family, that Hunter Biden is out there being appointed or somehow engaged in this other company, a board member, whatever it is, and Ukraine money is involved in it. Isn't that disgusting? It's just, it makes me want to puke. But this is what our government is today, and that's why it's so, so important for us to do something to get rid of these people. Get them out of office. We have to do everything we can. We've got to jump on the case of the Republican Party. Don't give money to the Republican National Committee when all they do is abuse it. Yeah, they've got some new leadership. We'll see. But if they don't support the MAGA candidates and the America First candidates and all the other stuff, then they just don't need to, they don't need my money. I'll give my money to the candidates that I believe are the are earning it, who truly believe in America First and want to save this country. And I'm not going to give money to corrupt political parties. And with that being said, I am going to open the mic for Sarge. And Sarge, if you want to do a little bit of a recap of everything we talked about last week and then pick up from there, you are more than welcome. So how are you doing this evening, Sarge? And we're ready.
I'm doing great. And, boy, it's really a pleasure to be here with one of the more educated audiences on Blog Talk Radio. And I am completely aware of the high standard of which I have to live up to, because there's some very well-informed people out there, and I can't be half-stepping. So I'm going to do my very best to tell what I know about this. I would like to emphasize that I am not an expert in religion. I have no pretenses whatsoever to that. I am at least more than noddingly familiar with the history of that region and the events that were impelled by the religious fervor on all sides of the conflict, to say nothing of the colonial machinations of the French and the British involved in it, and to a slightly lesser extent, the Ottoman Turks. So all of these things combined, to make this bitter stew that we find ourselves involved in today. So I'm going to kind of get away from religion. I'm going to relate the historical events that ensued out of all of these passions that combined to create the noxious mess called the Middle East in today's times. And in order to understand it, I think we have to go back historically and look as to how we got here. Because remember, history is simply the story of how everything came to be. And you cannot understand how things are today unless you understand how they came to be, at least historically and timeline event-wise. Because these things did ensue along a specific chronology and timeline. And by the way, Sal, I really appreciate you, what you said about July 4th. Don't talk about July 4th. And I would ask people to go back even further than the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. Go back to April 19th, 1775, when the shooting started between the colonists and the Britain on Lexington Concord Green. And even further back than that, at least to the end of the French and Indian War and the institution of the Intolerable Acts. Then you will understand why there's a July 4th, 1776. And I think everybody will be edified once they understand those events, just as we are looking into what happened in the Middle East to bring us to where we are today with October 7th and the war in Gaza. And I noticed that on your viewer, you've got a screen, and you're mentioning the Sykes-Picot agreement. And that little secret protocol between the British and the French, the United Kingdom and France, kind of started this whole thing. Because it was two diplomats, Mark Sykes for the British and François-Georges Picot for the French. And they came up with this secret protocol I didn't tell anybody else about. And as a result, the Arabs felt that the British reneged on their promise of a national Arab homeland in the region that they had considered Greater Syria, which would be pretty much the whole Palestine and the Levant region. And the Arabs felt that the British sold them out and didn't give them what they promised them in exchange for their alliance with the Entente in order to overthrow the Ottoman Turks. Because remember, the whole reason that this guy got started was because the Entente of France and Great Britain and later on the United States and Russia were looking for a way to outflank the Western Front. It was a deadlock, a line of trenches from the North Sea to Switzerland that was impregnable. It was held up by barbed wire and the machine gun and indirect fire artillery, and nobody could figure out a way to break the deadlock. So the Allies said, well, as if Winston Churchill had this brilliant idea. He come up with a lot of weird, really sometimes harebrained ideas sometimes, in addition to being a great statesman. But he thought they could send up an invasion force through the Dardanelles at the Gallipoli Peninsula, come up through the southern, through the Balkans, and outflank the western, the line on the Western Front, and bring it into the war. That was the strategy. But in order to do so, they had to do a lot of skullduggery that sold out everybody in the conflict. And to go over what happened briefly, what I discussed last week, the Sykes-Picot Agreement sort of launched it all off. And, you know, and the British said they wanted to liberate the people who had been oppressed by the Turks all the time, the Bedouins and the Arabs. They didn't like the Ottoman rule or the Ottoman Turks one little bit. And that's why they were so eager to join the revolt and ally with the British. And, you know, that story is recounted, of course, in Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. He wrote a book about it. You can go back. Watch the movie. The movie's a pretty good, even though it's Hollywood, it's still a pretty good grounding as well as great entertainment in the way the Arabs kind of looked at their alliance with the British. But anyway, and in those discussions, the Balfour Declaration evinced a sympathy for the Jewish people to have a homeland in Palestine. And they made three contrasting statements regarding their ambitions for Palestine, which has created conflict at that time and ever since. And mandatory Palestine became what resulted out of it under British rule until 1948. When you stop to think about it in terms of empire, from 1917, when Jerusalem fell to General Allenby, until 1948, that was the time of British colonial rule of that era, and that's a really remarkably short period of time for a colonial empire. That's, what, 31 years. So, and in the meantime, they're trying to figure out how they're going to wash their hands of it without offending everybody who was involved, and in the end, they wound up offending and pissing off everybody, so it didn't work. But let's come up to today, because we left off at the roots of Israel. We left off at the end of the British Mandate period. And now we're going to start off with the partition period, when the United Nations partitioned Israel after World War II. And we know what was the impetus for that. It was what happened to the Jews during the Nazi occupation of particularly the East, Poland, and the Soviet Union, and the deaths of so many European Jews during that time, and the fact that in many places when they tried to relocate after the end of the war, they were not allowed to return to their homeland. Now, I want to make it clear here. I don't really have a dog in this fight so much other than to say that, you know, I don't want the United States to get involved in this. I do not want us to get involved in this on either side. But if I was forced to pick a side, I would probably pick the Israeli side because of the fact that they are a sovereign nation that was attacked in a manner that no sovereign nation could possibly ignore after repeated attempts to make some sort of reconciliation with the people that are their neighbors, and they have been rejected at almost every turn despite innumerable conciliatory gestures. I mean, I forget the historian's name. That historian has said that the Palestinian and Arab people never seem to miss an opportunity, I mean, it's just amazing the number of times they have simply rejected efforts of conciliation. And oddly enough, many of the Arab leaders like Emir Faisal before and during World War I and right after World War I were very conciliatory towards the Zionists and the improvements that they brought to the region they settled in, and seemed to be eager to come to some sort of gesture, gesture of peace and reconciliation. Now, I'm sure they did not anticipate a Jewish state. Now, I'm going to say that right off the bat. They did not anticipate there's going to be a Jewish state. But they did recognize the valuable contribution of Zionists, not only to rebuilding, creating commerce, industry, reducing disease, extending life expectancy for the Arabs that chose to move in amongst them, but they saw all the Arabs that were coming to the settlements of Jewish concern, like in Haifa and Jaffa and Jerusalem, and they were noting the good that the Zionists had brought to the people of the region. They regularly noted this, and they said it openly. And that's what's really fascinating about this whole conflict. When I read these things, these were Arab leaders. I'm talking about Faisal was the son of the Saudi king who was a key leader in instituting the revolt against the Ottoman Turks. And Hussein was the high sheriff of the Holy Lands of Mecca. And they were all saying these kinds of things. It's really quite amazing if you go back and read the history. But I digress. Let's go to the partition. Okay, again, you got all these displaced Jews. They got nowhere to go. Nobody wants them. They're out there on boats trying to get into Palestine. Britain has severely restricted the amount of Jewish immigrants they're going to allow. The Arabs are demanding not to allow any in there. Again, another good movie you might want to see to give you a good sense of this is the movie Exodus. I believe in the last show we did, I had discussed the bombing of the King David Hotel, which was one of the instituters of that was Menachem Begin. And they did telephone a warning before they blew up the hotel. And the British being, you know, British can be arrogant a lot of times. They just said, we don't take orders from terrorists. And they chose to disregard it. The officers who did heed the warning got out and they were not harmed. But I think 40-something people were killed in the blast. But it be that as the way, both sides were involved in violent activities during this period. The Irgun and Haganah on the Israeli side, or not Israeli, but the Zionist side, and the Arab, various Arab factions on the Arab side. They were both going each other hammer and tongs. So the British were trying to work out an agreement that's acceptable to both Arabs and Jews, but again, they're insisting that the Arabs find the agreement acceptable, guaranteed failure, because the Arabs just were not going to make any concessions. They said it over and over again. There will be no Jewish state in Palestine, period, end of story. And that's when the British turned the issue completely over to the United Nations in February of 1947. And so what did the UN do? Well, the UN was a little bit more decisive back in them days because World War II was just over and everybody was kind of hot and trotting the idea of an international organization that could solve international disputes. Established a special commission on Palestine. They called the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine, or UNSCOP, to come up with a solution. And you had 11 nations, delegates from 11 nations that went to the area to find out what everybody already knew, that the conflicting national aspirations of Jews and Arabs could not be reconciled. There was not going to be a peaceable solution, no matter how mightily people might have tried. And when they got back, the delegates from seven of these nations, Canada, Czechoslovakia, Guatemala, the Netherlands, Peru, Sweden, and Uruguay, recommended the establishment of two separate states. Now, notice the United States is not involved here at all directly, at least not directly. I'm sure they were through back-channel diplomatic discussion. But the delegates were, again, from Canada, Czechoslovakia, Guatemala, the Netherlands, Peru, Sweden, and Uruguay. And the recommendation of these people, these delegates from this committee, said that that these two states, the Jewish and Arab state, would be joined by an economic union with Jerusalem as an internationalized enclave. I guess kind of similar to Shanghai between the world wars. Not exactly, but somewhat similar. Three nations, India, Iran, and Yugoslavia, recommended a unitary state with Arab and Jewish provinces. In other words, it would be kind of a coalition sort of government in one state. And I know that wouldn't have worked out worth a damn, but they did make that recommendation. Australia abstained from voting one way or the other. Now, obviously, the Zionists in Palestine were not satisfied with the really small territory allotted to them by the United Nations Commission. They were not at all happy that Jerusalem was severed from whatever Jewish state would be established under the UN mandate. But they did welcome the compromise. They said, okay, we don't like it. We're going to try to get some of it modified, but we're willing to compromise. They said, oh, hell no, not a bit. No Jewish state, period, end of story, that's it. No Jewish state, none. I mean, it is startling to hear their words. They just were not going to accept it, no way, shape, form, or fashion, no how. And I'd like to remind you again, that region had been under the complete control of the Ottoman Turkish Empire since the 14th century. From the 14th century right through to 1917, for 500 years, there were no independent nations in that entire region. The Ottoman Empire controlled the entire region of Greater Syria. Now, since this committee, this UNSCOP committee, rejected the Arab demand for a unitary state, the majority demand for partition, most people in the UN saw it as a more just solution. And by a vote of 33-13 with 10 abstentions on November 29, 1947, they voted for the partition of Palestine into two separate states. And now a lot of people believe that the partition plan gave the Jews all of the fertile land, the best part of the land, and that don't seem to be the case. Now, if you look at the partition plan map, the one that the partition plan set up, it looked like a big-ass checkerboard because Jewish towns and villages were spread throughout Palestine. Now, this wasn't as big a problem as much as the fact that the high living standards in Jewish cities and towns had brought large Arab populations to them. I'm telling you, Arabs were moving into the Jewish-controlled regions because of the higher standard of living, the better health care, the better sanitation, the better living conditions, and the better economic opportunities that Zionist enterprise had created. They were moving there by the thousands. They had not been in these regions to any great extent previously. I want to emphasize that. If you look at the censuses conducted in the region after World War I, you can see the numbers, and you can see them exponentially grow as Zionist development proceeded. So, now, in recognition of the fact that, you know, they needed to allow for additional Jewish settlement, the majority proposed the Jews to have more country in the northern part of the country around the Galilee and the large arid Negev desert region in the south. That was an arid, it wasn't rich, fertile growing land. It was mostly desert. It's called the Negev desert. That's what they allocated to the Zionists and the Jews because, you know, they said, well, look, if we're going to give them the land, let's give them part that's the least productive. It looks like the Zionists know how to make it work. Man, know how to do something with it. So we'll give it to them, and we'll let the other part that the Arabs seem to be more focused on, look, they can have that. Now, they also came up with Well, the Peel Commission had come up with this international settlement, and then the Peel Commission plan, which did not fly, it had sort of a corridor around the northern center part of Israel that led to the Mediterranean Sea through Jerusalem and just south of Tel Aviv through the region that's now known as Gaza. So, but that didn't fly because, again, they realized that the Israelis wanted to have some outlet to the Mediterranean Sea, and the partition plan had kind of cut them off from a great deal of it. And particularly in the southern region, where, you know, the southern region, of course, you got the Red Sea, and the only outlet to the Mediterranean is northwest through the Suez Canal. And the Israelis were concerned as to whether or not they would be able to have access to that corridor to the Mediterranean Sea. So the boundaries that did come up were based on demographics, solely on demographics, and that was part of the defect of the whole thing. There was no consideration for security for the Israeli state. I mean, the new state's borders were pretty much indefensible, kind of like when, you know, Czechoslovakia had to give up the state land with all the fortifications and forts on it to Hitler during the Munich, and that wasn't very good for Czechoslovakia. So when he decided to occupy the rump state that was left over, they really had no way to defend Czechoslovakia in any great degree. Similarly, we had a similar situation in Israel. Now, overall, the Jewish state was going to be about 5,500 square miles, about 55% of Palestine, and the population was going to be just about almost 550,000 Jews and 397,000 Arabs. Now, this is, again, within the Jewish state, okay? We ain't talking about what the Arab state pretty much ain't got no Jews whatsoever. It's none. There ain't no Jews there. But in the Arab state, there would be roughly 40% of the population was going to be Arab. Now, 92,000 Arabs lived in Tiberias, Safed, Haifa, and Beit Shean, and another 40,000 were Bedouin, most of whom were living in the desert. The remainder of the Arab population was spread throughout the Jewish state. The Arab state was going to be 4,500 square miles with a population of about 804,000 Arabs and 10,000 Jews. So you had 10,000 Jews living with 804,000 Arabs, and in Israel, what became Israel, you're going to have 397,000 Arabs living with 538,000 Jews. So you kind of get the picture of where this was going. And I don't think those 10,000 Jews were going to be there for very long once everything got established. Now, again, the land that the Israelis got was not all that great. 60% of the state, Jewish state, was in the desert in Negev. And the Arabs had most of the agricultural land, land that was considered prime, well, relative to that region, prime agricultural land. And then what further complicated the situation was that the UN insisted that Jerusalem remain apart from both states and be administered as an international zone. Now, guys, you got the holy shrines for both sides here in Jerusalem. You got the Temple Mount, and you got the Islamic shrine there. Now, how could anybody think that was going to work? You know, how could anybody think that they were going to be a little Swiss territory in the middle of this hotly conflicted area? But that's what the UN tried to say they could do. So this arrangement left more than 100,000 Jews in Jerusalem isolated from their country and circumscribed by the Arab state that surrounded it. So, now, the British census at the time, or whether their surveys, the time that, what they released at that time in 1947, 70% of the land in what would become Israel belonged to the mandatory government, and those lands would revert to Israeli control after the British departed. Another 9% of the land was owned by Jews, mainly Zionists, who had settled in the region and purchased land from Arab landowners. So 3% was owned by Arabs who became full citizens of the nation of Israel. So only 18% belonged to Arabs who left the country before and after the Arab invasion of Israel. This is another myth that the Zionists came in and kicked them off their land and ran them off. And it just didn't happen that way. The war did it, certainly, but they were importuned to leave the land by the Arab leaders. The Arab leaders told them, we don't want you in the way when we overrun these Jews and drive them into the Mediterranean Sea. So get out of our way so we can finish them off. So 80% of what was the historic land of Palestine and the Jewish national home, as defined by the League of Nations, was severed by the British in 1921. It became Transjordan. Jewish settlement there was barred. The UN petitioned the remaining 20% or so of Palestine in two separate states. When Transjordan annexed the West Bank in 1950 and Egypt occupied Gaza, Arabs had control of more than 80% of the territory of the Mandate, while the Jewish state held less than 18% of it. And again, I'd like to take it back to the Peel Commission in 1937, which was not the Mandate, but it kind of set much of the model for it. The Peel Commission in 1937, the British were setting up all kinds of these goddamn commissions trying to figure out a solution to this mess. Because they got Arabs rioting and Jews responding, and they're killing each other and having destruction of property, and British soldiers are getting injured and killed trying to separate the two sides. And it was a big mess. But the Peel Commission said that the only logical solution, man, this is 1937 now, so I want y'all to keep it in perspective. The only logical solution to resolving these contradictory aspirations was to partition Palestine. And again, the Jews would have got about 15%, which is even less than the UN mandate gave them, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Now, remember now, when you ask these dummies on these college campuses what they mean by the Mediterranean, from the river to the sea, a lot of them don't know. They talk about the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, the Mediterranean Ocean. That would literally sever Israel in two, and no sovereign nation is going to accept anything like that when the people who are going to take over the region have made their express stated goal your annihilation. That doesn't make sense for any country that wishes to survive. They're simply not going to accept it. I say any country. So that's what that, when they use those words, the river to the sea, talking about the Jordan River in the east and the Mediterranean Sea on the west. And the Arabs didn't want to have anything to do with this because they would have had to accept the creation of a Jewish state. And some Palestinians would have had to live under what they call Jewish domination, even though Arab citizens have every right legally that is Jewish Israeli citizens have. You don't have to be a Jew and be an Arab to live in Israel. You can be a Jew, be a complete Muslim, or a Druze, or a Circassian, or a Palasha, or anything else, and you can practice your faith, and you still be a full-fledged citizen. But anyway, that's what they said. They'd be under Jewish domination. Okay, whatever. And the Muslim religious leaders said supporters of the plan were heretics, while the political machine controlled by the Mufti, which was the same guy who allied himself with Adolf Hitler during the war, Mufti Hussein, he's called them traitors. So the Zionists didn't like the Peel Plan's boundaries because they would have been confined to 1,900 out of the 10,000 or so square miles that remained in Palestine. But the Zionists decided to negotiate with the British. But again, while the Arabs refused to do any negotiation or compromise, they said, no, we're not compromising. That was it. Like I said, that's what you call casting the die. The die is cast. So anyway, the British White Paper in 1939 called for the establishment of an Arab state in Palestine in 10 years for limiting Jewish immigration to no more than 75,000 over the next 5 years. And then afterwards, no one would be allowed in without the consent of the Arab population. And even though the Arabs have been granted a concession on Jewish immigration, they have been offered independence, they repudiated the White Paper. Again, they never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It is remarkable, as you study this history, how many times they just flat out said no negotiations. I mean, they were pushing it to war. Like I said, sides can't get along on national boundaries, they go to war. It's what we did with Mexico. It wasn't going to be, hey, the Mexicans completely rejected every proposal that was made. They rejected the proposal on the southern border. The United States kept offering a negotiated solution. Mexico, nope, it's the Nueces River. It's not the Rio Grande. That's it. We ain't talking no more. And whenever that happens, talking stops. You know what happens next? World War. So, at the time of the 47 petition resolution, the Arabs had a majority in Western Palestine as a whole, 1.2 million Arabs versus 600,000 Jews. But the Jews were a majority in the area allotted to them by the resolution and in Jerusalem. And the Jews never had a probability, chance, or even likelihood of getting majority in the country given the restrictive immigration policy of the British. They were enforcing that policy, too, because they wanted to placate the Arabs. Only a few, less than 10,000 a year, or just slightly over 10,000 a year coming into the country, and the Arabs were flooding into that region by the tens of thousands, so there was no likelihood they ever were going to become a majority. And Palestine's Arab population would have been declining prior to the mandate in 1922, started this exponential growth because Arabs from all the countries were free to come because they wanted, as I said earlier, they wanted to take advantage of the rapid economic development and the improved health conditions that the Zionist settlement were creating. That is crucial to understanding this. That is crucial to understanding this. So, again, even though I did say earlier that, you know, they established the boundaries without regard to defensible security solutions, particularly for the state of Israel, and they did it solely on the basis of demographics, there were some other factors at work. The conclusion that the territorial claims of Jews and Arabs were irreconcilable, that the most logical compromise was creation of two states. Ironically, that same year, now this is what really gets me, man, the same year, 1947, the Arab members of the United States supported the partition of the Indian subcontinent and the creation of the new predominantly Muslim state of Pakistan. Now, we know how that worked out. Literally, millions of people were killed in fighting over that. But the Arab states in the UN overwhelmingly supported to create the partition. So, now when people say the Arabs were prepared to compromise to avoid bloodshed, all I got to do is refer you to what their leaders were saying. Okay? When the Jewish agency representatives, David Horowitz and Abba Eben, made a last-ditch effort to get a compromise in a meeting with Arab League Secretary Abd al-Rahman Azam Pasha, on September 16, 1947, this is what he said, and I'm quoting from the meeting. Here you go. The Arab world is not in a compromising mood. It's likely, Mr. Horowitz, that your plan is rational and logical, but the fate of nations is not decided by rational logic. Nations never concede. They fight. You won't get anything by peaceful means or compromise. You can perhaps get something, but only by the force of your arms. We shall try to defeat you. I am not sure we'll succeed, but we'll try. We were able to drive out the Crusaders, but on the other hand, we lost Spain and Persia. It may be that we shall lose Palestine, but it's too late to talk of peaceful solutions. Meanwhile, the Grand Mufti, Hitler's future henchman, and his henchmen made sure to silence supporters of partition. Now, one of the Mufti's associates who spied for the Haganah said this, quote, the opposition, which was prepared to agree to partition, had to go along with the opponents of partition after they learned of the decision to murder everyone who supported that opinion, even if they were amongst the greatest leaders. So, there you go. Now, I've been speaking a little while. I've said what I had to say about the partition. Thing I'm going to talk about the war of 1948, but I'll take a break now to answer any questions if anybody wishes to talk about any of this. And again, I like to emphasize I want to speak on the historical record. And anybody wants to speak about it, hash out anything, or make any comment one way or the other, we can take a brief break to go over that. What do you say to that, Sally?
Well, I see one person with their hand up wanting to add. They just now put their hand up. So let's see what they want to say. It's 9737. Can we get your first name, please? And hopefully your microphone.
This is Daniel.
Go.
Can you hear
me?
Hey,
Daniel, how you doing? Yep, we can hear you.
I'm doing well. Listen to the show, and this may seem a little unrelated, but I'm going to relate it back to what you're talking to, and I think you're the right people to ask. Did you hear about that fellow who made a speech? He was a football player for the Chiefs, Harrison Butker.
Yes, about the culture speech. He was speaking about culture.
Exactly, and there was a lot of controversy about what he said, but I was curious what your thoughts were, if you thought it was so wrong.
I didn't think it was wrong at all. I thought it was pretty much spot on. He understood the basic implications of the trends in culture that are destroying the family, and he was speaking that we need to push back against it. I didn't see a thing wrong with what he said.
I liked
it
personally.
I
liked it.
What's that, ma'am?
I said, personally, I liked what he said. I know there were some people who tried to take offense to what he said in reference to women being homemakers, but I think he was actually trying to say how important it is to manage a household and raise your own children and don't outsource that type of thing. So, again, I liked it. I know that's where some people were trying to demean some of the references to women.
Yeah, I think he was also trying to say that women who choose to be homemakers and manage the family household are every bit as vital as those who aspire to be chief executive officers of corporations. I think that's another thing he was trying to say, and I think I don't see anything at all wrong with that.
Right.
Well,
maybe even more so.
I agree with you, and I was especially curious to get the perspective of a woman because I know a lot of women were offended, but there's plenty of women in my life who had the same feeling. You know, I think there's a false narrative that, you know, the only thing that a woman can do in life is to replicate a man's journey. So to go and be a CEO and to go and, you know, into the cities and the big cities and get the high pressure job. And, you know, there's a lot of downside to that, too, for the family, for the woman.
I don't want to cut you off here, but and we can have a whole show on just this discussion. We have to face the fact that part of the game was to totally confuse the roles of men and women. I've had other conversations like, okay, equal but different. When women want equality, does that mean the men should be swimming with them and all this other kind of craziness? Understanding what equal but different means. I really don't like the fact they're trying to put the women back into the draft or put the women into the draft. This is apparently something the Democrats are doing right now and some of these other things. I think we need to reconsider what the roles are, but I don't think a woman should be hostage where she is the servant of the husband. I think it should be a partnership and a fair relationship. And I think there should be honor. We should admire those who take the time to raise their own children because that's really one of the most important jobs. I myself have said for many years I don't believe in outsourcing parenthood, and that's what public education has become, and look at what public education has done to the family and to the generation and to the culture. It's all been twisted in such a way. So now if you want to tie that back into what we're discussing, how the roles of men and women are in different cultures, whatever that, how you're tying this into tonight's discussion, please feel free to do so.
The reason I brought it up is because you know, I have three daughters, and it's funny because Butker is a friend of a friend sort of the family. And so they had a Girl Scout graduation thing, and I actually got him to come and to give a small speech. It was sort of done as a favor to me. And some of the things he said are exactly what you're talking about now and today. He said he could bring, you know, he said to the girls, you know, you can be whatever you want to be, but there's no better enjoyment than knowing that you support your man and your family, okay? And he said that he could bring things like maids and all that into the house, but he was very happy to have a wife and a partner do it and to keep her busy and to
make her feel fulfilled as a mother. And I'm curious if you agree with that.
Yeah, I don't think a woman has to go and work in corporate America to be successful. I don't. I mean, that's what this comes down to. The fact is, we've marginalized motherhood. We've marginalized homemaking. And it's one of the toughest jobs there is, if it's not the toughest job, trying to manage a household and manage the raising of the kids, especially if you homeschool them. We need to recognize what it takes to do that job instead of acting like you couldn't do anything else. So you did this because you couldn't do anything else. You're too dumb to do anything else. You didn't get it, whatever. All those kind of things. I don't – and there's that's been something that's happened over the years. And then, again, I don't want to be talking about feminism and the woman's rights and all the women's movement thing for the rest of the show. But when we go back to why did it happen, what was the deal? At the same time, should a woman be beaten by a man because she can't support herself and she's forced in a situation? The only way she can survive, whatever, you don't do that either. And where did it all start? A lot of it was part of the culture change of trying to destroy this culture by marginalizing what women do and changing the roles. And, of course, we've wussified what men do, too. So now men have babies. I mean, the insanity of what it's all being done. How much of it is that?
Well, he did say towards the end of his speech to the girls that he felt there was a tremendous amount of pressure on men and women now to be gay, and that he did not approve of a lot of this gay behavior.
Well, it's part breaking down the culture. Why did we have to go and have this sexual revolution of whatever sort, whatever you want to call the insanity of what's happening here? What truly is the underlying reason for anybody being sexually confused with what God gave them at birth and what has happened to them and whatever else? So much of it is by abuse that they may have been molested or whatever else. I don't know. I'm not going to try to go into what creates a homosexual individual. Everything to do with transgendering and all this other nonsense, this is all part of a destruction of a culture and taking and manipulating the kids. Zelensky, I think Obama made reference to it as well. You take the child, so many years of the child, and you can manipulate them into anything. So everything they have done with this transgender crapola with children is truly child abuse and it's evil. And people have to reject it. And that's why we have to take the kids out of public education. If you want to talk on the science at some point on another show, I do find it more interesting that it seems, I don't have the statistics, it seems like men gravitate to being women more so than women to men. And I see a lot of the women who went to men are doing the transitioning back, but it was all part of a brainwashing scheme. So I don't understand the drag queen routine, men wanting to be women and dress up like women. I don't ask me to explain what's going on in their heads or the rest of their bodies,
cultural,
whatever. You know.
And I think a lot of it is the blending and the criticism of the female role in the household. Like when he came to speak to the girls, and it was such a nice fella, and he stayed after the speech and talked to everyone. But, you know, one of the jokes he said, but it really resonated, and people did laugh. Is he said, you know, a lot of you young ladies, you might be told you gotta get up and you gotta dream of being the CEO. But you know, my wife's the CEO of Fold and Laundry, and we are so grateful. We're way more grateful for her than any Fortune 500 CEO. And I just thought that was so true, you know.
Yeah. Well, it is. We should value the family life and what it means to raise a child, and trying to put a price tag on properly raising a child and those types of things is sick. Again, I don't want to be talking about that all night. If you want to, I'll give you one more chance to bring that back to the Middle East.
Yeah, sure. Well, hang on. I do have a recording of him from the event. I'll just play that, and I think that'll make my point here that I want to get to.
I not only married my best friend, but I also married an excellent dishwasher.
And I just thought that was a great statement he made.
Yeah.
Honey, thank you for washing all of those dishes. And you make ham sandwiches.
You know what, though? I got to say this about this labor thing and feminism and all that. Look,
one of the reasons that, you know, the male lifespan is lower than women, and it's not the only reason, obviously, but it's a significant factor, and that is that so many men die in the efforts to maintain civilization. They do the most dangerous scut work that keeps civilization alive. They work in sewers. They work in mines. They drive trucks. They do the kind of deep-sea fishing. They do the kind of thing that keeps civilization going, that is hazardous and dangerous, overwhelmingly more than women. Yes, some women do it. But if you, I believe I saw a survey that said the kind of gut, sinew, dangerous work that keeps civilization going, men occupy 95 to 97% of those positions. I noticed that many of these women only seem to want to aspire toward goals that are somewhat glamorous or prestigious. I don't think they seem to have much desire for the scut work that men routinely do and die in doing. And I just can't help but notice that.
Well, he made this statement here about woman's choice, and I thought this was funny but also poignant. I'll play it for you.
I believe in a woman's choice, cooking or cleaning.
We're getting totally off topic here. And if you want to have a show
that,
just
though?
On that, we could definitely do it. But, I mean, if you're trying to play games with the meaning, it's not being given as an insult to say that. Hey, what would men be if someone wasn't there cooking for them? And I remember it used to be the expression, the way to a man's heart was through his stomach. I remember that years ago. It takes a lot. And it's not a matter of one thing or another. It's a matter of managing the whole household, doing all of those things. And women are much more adept to multitasking while the child is crying and, you know, the other everything that goes with raising a family and taking care of a household. So,
he said to the girls, I'll give you one last shot here, but then we're getting back on the topic. Sure. I'll play you one last thing, and I promise we'll get to it.
I'm not getting the connection between this and Middle East.
Here it comes.
My wife's mouth is used for pleasure and not nagging me.
Oh, Lord. Well, there it is. Okay. There we go. All right, now we know.
What do you think of that?
Oh, we see the connection.
And please click my asshole before I jerk off.
Jeez.
And the girls loved it.
Okay. Well, I was afraid this person was going to be some kind of a pervert out there trying to stir up stuff. Try to ignore that last part, people. This was just disgusting. I'll work on editing that crap out. So anyway.
Okay. Good luck with it.
That person's gone.
Okay.
Let's continue on.
Well, let's get to the nitty gritty because I mean, look, these two sides are not getting along. They want a divorce, but they don't want a peaceful or amicable settlement. And war was as inevitable as night following day. And it started in 1948. The Arabs made it clear they were going to go to war to prevent a Jewish state from coming into being. The chairman of the Arab Higher Committee said the Arabs are going to fight for every inch of their country. The holy men of Al-Azhar University in Cairo said the Muslim world is going to proclaim a jihad, a holy war against the Jews. Jamal Husseini, the Arab High Committee spokesman, told the UN prior to the partition vote that the Arabs would drench the soil of our beloved country with the last drop of our blood. So that prediction started to come true almost right away when the UN adopted a partition resolution on November 29, 1947. The Arabs declared a protest strike and riots ensued, and 62 Jews were killed and 32 Arabs in the rioting that followed. And the violence escalated throughout the end of the year right up to 1948. The first large-scale assaults and combat started on January 9, 1948, when 1,000 Arabs attacked Jewish communities in northern Palestine. By February, the British said so many Arabs had infiltrated that they didn't have the forces to turn them back. The first phase of the war lasted from about November 29, 1947 to April 1, 1948. Palestinian Arabs took the offensive. They had help from volunteers from neighboring countries. Jews had very heavy casualties, and passage along most of their major roadways and road nets was very badly disrupted. On April 26th, King Jordan said this. Transjordan's king, King Abdullah, he said this. All our efforts to find a peaceful solution to the Palestine problem have failed. The only way left for us is war. I will have the pleasure and honor to save Palestine. And on May 4th, 1948, Abdullah's Arab Legion attacked Kfar Etzion. The defenders drove them back, but the Legion came back a week later. After 2 days, the outnumbered and badly equipped settlers were overwhelmed. Many of them got massacred after they surrendered. Now, this was prior to the invasion by the regular Arab armies that followed Israel's Declaration of Independence. Now, let me tell you about their offensive plan. From the northwest, you had the Lebanese army making a three-pronged attack south through Acre and a thrust in the direction of Tiberias. On the northeastern, you had the Syrian army, again, a two-pronged defensive aimed around Tiberias, a pincer movement. The Iraqi army had a four-pronged assault right through the heart and center of Israel. The Jordanian army was flanking them in another four-pronged assault centered around Jerusalem. And from the south, the Egyptian army was striking toward Gaza, Beersheba, Etzion block, and Jerusalem. So you got five Arab armies taking on the badly equipped Israeli Zionists. I mean, a lot of people make this. If you go look at the documentary of that time, the Israelis are equipped with the greatest hodgepodge of weapons. Most of them, ironically, Axis and German weapons. They had MG-34s. They had K-98 rifles. They had MP-47 machine guns. They had mortars from Czech mortars, light howitzers. They had a Messerschmitt ME-109 fighter airplanes that would have been a Luftwaffe fighter aircraft. They had some American bombers, like obsolete B-17 bombers and a few. It had to be a nightmare to use all those different calibers of ammunition and try to keep them resupplied. Just look at the photos from that period. You don't see American equipment for the most part in Israeli hands. Not at all. Most everything they had was gotten on the international arms market, much of it World War II surplus, and particularly, ironically, surplus from Czechoslovakia, Germany, and Poland. It was really quite remarkable to think that they were able to prevail, and particularly the Arab Legion, because the Arab Legion was commanded by a British officer named John Gabut Glubb. And he had been a British general, and he resigned his commission to become Generalissimo of the Arab Legion. He was an excellent officer, an excellent tactician and commander, and this is what he said. He said, early in January, the first detachments of the Arab Liberation Army began to infiltrate into Palestine from Syria. Some came through Jordan and even through Amman. They were in reality to strike the first blow in the ruins of the Arabs of Palestine. So the UN Palestine Commission, which was never permitted by the Arabs or the British to go to Palestine to implement the resolution, reported to the Security Council on February 16, 1948, that powerful Arab interests, both inside and outside Palestine, are defying the resolution of the General Assembly and are engaged in a deliberate effort to alter by force the settlement envisioned therein. And the Arabs are very blunt, as I said earlier, about taking responsibility for starting the war. Jamal Husseini told the Security Council on April 16, 1948, and I quote, "The representative of the Jewish agency told us yesterday that they were not the attackers, that the Arabs had begun the fighting. We did not deny this. We told the whole world that we were going to fight. But despite the disadvantage in numbers, organization, and weaponry, the Israelis began to take the initiative in the weeks from April 1st until the Declaration of Independence on May 14th. The Haganah captured several major towns, including Tiberias and Haifa, and temporarily opened the road to Jerusalem. The partition resolution was never suspended or rescinded. Israel, the Jewish state in Palestine, was born on May 14th as the British finally left the country. Five, again, I got to keep emphasizing this, guys, five Arab armies, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, immediately invaded Israel. Now, this is what the Secretary General of the Arab League, again, this gentleman of, I referred to earlier, named Abd al-Rahman Azam Pasha, quote, "It will be a war of annihilation. It will be a momentous massacre in history that will be talked about like the massacres of the Mongols or the Crusades." Now, as to the idea that the United States was the only nation that criticized the Arab assault on Israel, if you look at the historical record at the time, the United States, Soviet Union, and most other nation states recognized Israel right after it declared independence on May 14, 1948, and immediately condemned the Arabs for their aggression. The United States urged a resolution charging the Arabs with the breach of the peace. And the Soviet delegate, Andrei Gromyko, told the Security Council on May 29, 1948, "This is not the first time that the Arab states, which organized the invasion of Palestine, have ignored a decision of the Security Council or of the General Assembly. The USSR delegation deems it essential that the Council should state its opinion more clearly and more firmly with regard to this attitude of the Arab states toward decisions of the Security Council. And on June 15th, Security Council threatened to cite the Arab governments for aggression under the UN Charter. By this time, the Israeli Defense Forces had succeeded in stopping this five-nation-led Arab offensive in the initial phase of the fighting had ended." I think that's one of the most remarkable episodes in military history, that they were able to beat back all these multi-pronged, simultaneous assaults going on at once. A remarkable piece of military history. So, when the Jews won their independence, the Zionists and the Jews and Israelis won their war of independence with very little help from the West, and in fact, they won despite actions that undermined their military strength. Now, President Truman did support the partition resolution, but most of the people in the State Department did not, and they tried to sabotage it. Now, some of these officials that they called Arabists were anti-Semitic. Others feared supporting partition would harm our relations with the Arab states, especially oil producers like Saudi Arabia. And the early Cold Warriors thought that the new Jewish state might side with the commies or provide an opening for the Soviet Union to spread its influence in the region. Because after all, those Israelis, man, they were socialists to the max. They were just about Marxist in many cases. And there was a reasonable fear the Israelis might go over to the Soviet bloc, especially since the Soviet bloc was making friendly entreaties toward the state of Israel. So anyhow, the Arabists decided to prevent the Jews from obtaining the means to defend themselves. Undersecretary of State Robert Lovett argued that, quote, "The Arabs might use arms of U.S. origin against Jews, or Jews might use them against Arabs," end quote. And on December 5th, 1947, the United States imposed an arms embargo on the region. Truman didn't want to recognize the embargo because he saw it as an impediment to partition, and he went along because he hoped it would prevent more bloodshed. Now, given the fact that Britain had rejected Lovett's request to suspend weapons shipments to the Arabs and subsequent agreements to provide additional arms to to Iraq and Transjordan, I mean, this is kind of pretty naive, if you ask me. I don't understand how he possibly thought such a state of affairs could make anything any better. The Arabs didn't have any difficulty in getting all the arms they needed. If you look at the way, if you look at the documentary at the time, they were uniformly equipped. They had weapons that used the same caliber of ammunition. They had a uniformity of standard. It was clear that they were reasonably well equipped. Jordan's Arab Legion was armed and trained by the British. It was led by the British officer, John Pasha Glubb. At the end of 1948 and beginning of 1949, British Royal Air Force planes flew with Egyptian squadrons over the Israeli-Egypt border. And the Jews had to smuggle weapons, principally from Czechoslovakia, because the Czechs had a lot of that German equipment from World War II that they had impounded and seized and confiscated. And the Soviets, of course, stored a lot of it in Czechoslovakia. And when Jewish declared its independence, the army did not have one single medium or heavier howitzer, not one single armored fighting vehicle that could be considered a tank. And its air force consisted of 9 obsolete planes that would be transport, heavy bombers, and fighters. 9 of them. That was the whole damn air force. Israel wasn't outmanned despite being outgunned, despite the hugely outnumbering Arab armies. The Haganah had 60,000 trained fighters, many of whom had seen combat in World War II, fighting with the British and with the various underground movements in Eastern Europe against the Germans. The newly formed Israeli Defense Force could only arm and mobilize about 32,500, which is roughly the size of the enemy forces. And on the eve of war, the chief of operations, Yigal Yadin, told David Ben-Gurion, "The best we can tell you is that we have a 50-50 chance." So, now if you look at the war, what is really striking at the time is that lack of Palestinian involvement. Now, even though Palestinians claim this close connection to the land, going back centuries, and they obviously want independence. I mean, look at the way these people on these campuses are talking today. A surprisingly low percentage fought in 1948. In village after village, Arab residents defied the call to arms, and those who joined often did to obtain free weapons for their personal protection and then return home. And a small number who joined the fight often deserted. One commander complained the Palestinians were unreliable, excitable, and difficult to control in an organized warfare, virtually unemployable. So the Arab invasion of Israel in 1940 has failed. Because of the aggression, the Arabs wound up with less territory than if they had accepted partition. But it did cost Israel one hell of a lot. You know, they didn't get out scot-free. Many of their most productive fields were gutted and mined. The citrus groves, for decades, the basis of the Yishuv Jews' community economy, were largely destroyed. Military expenditures totaled about $500 million in 1948 dollars. Worse yet, 6,373 Israelis were killed, nearly 1% of the Jewish population of 650,000. About 10,000 Arabs were killed. Now, had the West enforced the partition resolution or given the Jews the capacity to defend themselves, probably many lives on both sides would have been saved. And the Arab countries signed an armistice with Israel in 1949. Egypt started first, followed by Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Iraq was the only country that did not sign an agreement with Israel, at least an armistice agreement. And they chose instead to withdraw their troops and hand over their sector to Jordan's Arab Legion. None of the Arab states would negotiate a peace agreement and never did. None of them ever did. None of them ever have to this date. Meanwhile, except, of course, the ones that were not directly involved in the fighting in 1948. I mean, Saudi Arabia has. Egypt did too in 1976. But anyway, most of them didn't. And 40 of the 59 member states of the United Nations had recognized Israel by the end of 1949. So you got that going. The Israelis managed to secure the independence, managed to beat back this 5 Arab army invasion, and now they're established as a state with diplomatic recognition by most of the United Nations member states. And the Arab boycott was formally declared by the newly formed Arab League Council on December 2nd. That was before the war started. They started to boycott the Arabs because the people were saying that the boycott Israel was a result of the creation of Israel, and that's simply not true. If you look at the chronology, it started in 1945 before the Arab state, the proposal to partition the Palestinian region was even brought up. They were talking about a unitary state in the region, not a partition state. So, and they said that Jewish products and manufactured goods will be considered undesirable in the Arab countries, and all Arab institutions, organizations, merchants, commission agents, and individuals were called upon to refuse to deal in, distribute, or consume Zionist products or manufactured goods. And in their declaration, the terms Jewish and Zionist were used synonymously. So even before Israel was established, Arab states declared an economic boycott against the Jews of Palestine. So this all brings us up to the real cause of what's going on today, and that is the 1956 Suez War and the 1967 Six-Day War, because that's when the present boundaries of the current state of the conflict were primarily established. And anybody, I'd like to pause again now for a moment before I move on to this next block of discussion, because this one really is significant to understanding what's going on there today with Gaza, the West Strip, Lebanon, Syria, all of that. I mean, you understand that, you can see how we got to where we are today with the current mess. So if anybody would like to say anything about it, let's do it now before we move on to that.
Okay, well, if anybody out there wants to join in who has useful information, not like this last caller, to go ahead and push one. I see you out there, but no one's got their hand up to speak. But the whole thing, too, about the Palestine, what the real meaning of Palestine, there is no Palestine. That's the other part that just somehow, I mean, it's throughout this whole discussion, and somehow we've got to get people on the right page on what Palestine really means. Because we hear all the craziness, the what happens in Washington with some of our representatives and everything else, so it's all pretty bizarre. And just a quick note: some of you, I think, actually joined just in time to miss that one other caller who came, tried to hijack the show and did for a few minutes. Let's all say a prayer for this person who's got a seriously perverted mind, must be sexually confused on his own rights, whatever. And I apologize that anybody had to listen to any part of that. Most of it was just silliness. And the only part I would say is it's just too bad because as we kept trying to get him, okay, relate this to the Middle East. The truth is the women in the Middle East have been treated terribly. There's something to be said about women's rights. As a woman, what do you have the right to do, and are you expected to be abused? Are you expected to do whatever the man wants at any time and whatever else, or be stoned and, you know, all these kind of things that happen? So it's too bad that individual, which who knows, I hope they're still listening, even though I can't see them out there, that they might go do some self-reflection and realize that they're wasting their time. They may actually have some kind of talent, but they're wasting it on such stupid things like this and disturbing people, when in fact there is truly an issue for women's rights, women's suffering. What happens in the Middle East, the way women are treated in the Middle East, it's pretty despicable from the different things I've seen. And so we'll just kind of leave it there. And again, just an apology if anybody who's out there listening heard any part of that, because that wasn't part of the scheduled show. Just a lost soul out there who needs some prayers for him. So pray for that lost soul. Okay. Nobody has put their hand up to speak.
It was standard trolling, Sally. You know what I mean? Standard trolling. Just
sort of
a theater of the absurd. That's what trolls do.
Yeah. And again, these are truly lost souls. They don't know what else to do with their time, I guess. And now I have another person out there that I don't quite recognize that number. Let's see. So hopefully I don't have another troll. Hopefully they can add something useful to this conversation. Otherwise, they will get disconnected quickly as well. But with that being said, 6503, would you give us your first name and please keep on topic?
Yes, of course. Hi, this is Kevin, and I want to apologize for whoever that was, and you guys handled it quite well, so you should be proud of yourself.
Well, you gotta expect that kind of thing. I mean, it's blog talk. You have to expect it. If you're not prepared for it, it's kind of like going into a nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare without the gas mask. You got to be ready for it because that's just the way it is. Just the way it is.
Yeah, it's,
it is.
It's unfortunate. I know you only have limited control over it. I always worry about kids listening. Unfortunately, my children did hear some of it, and that's very unfortunate for your listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there anything in reference to the topic, the Middle East, that you wanted to add? Obviously, I appreciate your understanding on that, and I'm going to do what I can to go back and cut that out of there so nobody has to listen to it, but I'll have to go edit it out.
I don't know what he was saying about a mouth or his wife's mouth or something horrible, you know.
Okay, if you're going to start this too, so you're going to go, okay, thank you. Okay, well.
Yeah.
Two down.
Appreciate it.
I thought I recognized that voice, even though they were playing with another phone number.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is such a lost soul. Everybody, please, everybody that's listening out there right now, say a prayer for that lost soul. Say a prayer for Kevin Daniel, because they apparently need some serious therapy. And I don't do that as a profession. I'm sorry, I'm not a professional therapist. For mental health diseases such as that. So please, everybody, just say a prayer for them. You know, lost souls. We have lost souls. And unfortunately, so much of this, because of what's happened to our culture with the perverts out there, the drag queens and whatever else, some of these people have you know, I guess they've lost their way. They've had their upbringing didn't give them any grounding, whatever else. And so we just have to keep praying for their sad souls, and hopefully they'll become some kind of useful individual at some point in time. So anyway, well, let's see who's if I get any other weird numbers out there, I probably won't take them. So it better be the numbers that I have on my checklist of high quality callers who we know are going to talk about the topic and have some serious discussion, not the perverted stuff like that. Anyway. Anyone else want to join in? Let's see. There was Suzette had something out there. Some say it was of God that Israel, I think it means Israel, was able to defeat the Arab army. Israel, yes.
Not just the Arab army, five of them. That's what gets me. Five of them engaging in multi-pronged attacks simultaneously. That is amazing to me.
Yep. Yep, so, okay, well, tell somebody else. That's the only question or comment I see in reference to the discussion for tonight. And please continue on.
Okay, well, let's talk about what happened during the 1956 Suez War and the 67 Six-Day War. Because now we're getting into the modern, the genesis of the modern day problems there. And I guess you could kind of track it back to about 1948. When the U.N. Security Council called on Israel and the Arab states to negotiate an armistice agreement. And Ralph Bunche was a U.N. mediator sent there by the United States, the famous black man, black United States citizen, who administered these negotiations. He insisted on direct bilateral talks between Israel and each Arab state. Armistice agreements between Egypt, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria were concluded by the summer of 1949, Iraq, though, which did not, as I said earlier, did not take part in those negotiations. And on December 11, 1948, General Assembly adopted a resolution calling on the parties to negotiate peace. All of the Arab delegations, once again, voted against it. After 1949, the Arabs insisted that Israel accept the borders in the 1947 partition resolution and repatriate the Palestinian refugees before they would negotiate and into the war that they themselves had initiated. Now, talk about the use of an Israeli word, chutzpah, or Hebrew word. I mean, that just takes cake. They start the war, and then they want to blame Israel for not repatriating people that were in the plight they were in because they invaded Israel. I mean, that's okay, whatever. This is a pretty novel way to bring about negotiations. And they would use this and whenever they got defeated in the future, because I guess they figured it worked the first time. the doctrine of limited liability war. Now, too bad the Germans couldn't get a deal like that, because they wound up losing Prussia after they lost World War II. And they ain't never got it back. It's part of Poland now. It's Galicia. What used to be Prussia is now Galicia, because Germany had to assume liability for starting a war and losing it. But anyway, this, like I said, this limited liability war is really something, man. You know, I guess only with the start of intersectionality can you get away with something like that. So when you got this thing going, this kind of theory going on, now aggressor can reject a compromise settlement and gamble on war to win everything, comforted in the knowledge that even if they lose, they can insist on reinstating the status quo ante. Man, that's having your cake and eating it too, ain't it? Jesus, I mean, I can't get over that one. Well, we'll start a war, but if we lose, we don't want to accept any consequences for it. It's amazing. That's just amazing. But they've been getting away with it ever since. And then they, now let's look at what happened in 1956 with the Suez Crisis. Okay? Take a look at it. Now, Egypt maintained its state of belligerency with Israel after the armistice agreement had been signed. Now, what you saw was Egypt closed the Suez Canal to Israeli shipping. Now, on August 9, 1949, the UN Mixed Armistice Commission upheld Israel's complaint that Egypt was illegally blocking the canal. Part of the agreement for Egypt maintaining administrative control over the canal when they attained their independence from Great Britain was that they would keep the canal open to international shipping for any nation that was not a belligerent in a war. Okay, so that was part of the deal. And Ralph Bunche, who was the UN negotiator, said that there should be free movement for legitimate shipping and no vestiges of the wartime blockade should be allowed to remain, as they are inconsistent with both the letter and the spirit of the armistice agreement. So, on September 1st, 1951, the Security Council ordered Egypt to open the canal to Israeli shipping. Egypt said, hell no, you ain't getting your ships through our canal. So, Egypt was equally stubborn in refusing to lift the blockade Nasser imposed on the Straits of Tehran, which, in case you don't know, lead to the Red Sea and access to the Indian Ocean. Okay, so the Red Sea is critical to getting to the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean and all of the maritime and commerce trading that thereto can ensue. They also impeded communication with Asia and East Africa, and they violated Israel's right to freedom of navigation. Remember, part of Egypt assuming control of the Suez Canal was their agreement to allow it to remain open to all international system, shipping, not engage in belligerent actions against other powers. Remember, they had an armistice with Israel, so that would not apply in Israel's case. So, the Egyptian foreign minister, a guy named Mohammed Salah al-Din, said in 1954, the Arab people will not be embarrassed to declare, we shall not be satisfied except by the final obliteration of Israel from the map of the Middle East. So Nasser started to get weaponry from the Soviet Union in 1955. He wanted to build his weapon arsenal for future confrontation with Israel. Now, in the short term, he employed this new tactic to prosecute Egypt's war with Israel, and he announced it publicly on August 31st, 1955. Quote, Egypt has decided to dispatch her heroes, the disciples of Pharaoh and the sons of Islam, and they will cleanse the land of Palestine. There will be no peace on Israel's border because we demand vengeance, and vengeance is Israel's death. Now, these were the men that came to be known as the Fedayeen, trained and equipped by Egyptian intelligence to engage in hostile action on the border and to infiltrate Israel and commit acts of sabotage and murder. Now, the Fedayeen operated mainly from bases in Jordan, so that Jordan would bear the brunt of Israel's retaliation, which was inevitable. The terrorist attacks violated the armistice agreement provision that prohibited the initiation of hostilities by paramilitary forces. Nevertheless, the UN Security Council condemned Israel for its counterattacks. So, you know, Israel's saying, oh, what the hell are they telling us this? They're not doing anything about these attacks on our territory by the Egyptian Fedayeen, and Nasser is ever acting like he's got a right to do it. So, the escalation continued with the Egyptian blockade of Israel's shipping lane in the Straits of Tehran, and then Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal on July of 1956, and he made clear why he did it. I am not solely fighting against Israel itself. My task is to deliver the Arab world from destruction through Israel's intrigue, which has its roots abroad. Our hatred is very strong. There is no sense in talking about peace with Israel. There's not even the smallest place for negotiation. And less than 2 weeks later, Egypt signed a tripartite agreement with Syria and Jordan that put Nasser in command of all three armies. So you got this blockade going on in the Suez Canal and the Gulf of Aqaba to Israeli shipping, combined with increased Fedayeen attacks and the bellicosity of Arab statements. And this prompts Israel, with the backing of Britain and France, to attack Egypt on October 29, 1956. The Israeli attack was successful. It was very well administered, like a lightning commando raid. Israeli forces captured the Gaza Strip, much of the Sinai, and Sharm al-Sheikh. Estimates of casualties range from 171 to 231 Israelis and about 3,000 Egyptians. Now, Israeli ambassador to the UN, Abba Ibn, explained why the Israelis and the British and the French did what they did. He said, during the 6 years which this belligerency has operated in violation of the Armistice Agreement, there occurred 1,843 cases of armed robbery and theft, 1,339 cases of armed clashes with Egyptian armed forces, 435 cases of incursion from Egyptian-controlled territory, and 172 cases of sabotage perpetuated by Egyptian military units and Fedayeen in Israel. As a result of these actions of Egyptian hostility within Israel, 364 Israelis were wounded and 101 killed. In 1956 alone, as a result of this aspect of Egyptian aggression, 28 Israelis were killed and 127 wounded. Now, a lot of people say that the United States evinced support for Israel during the Suez War. Now, if you look at the historical record, it's as clear as a bell. Dwight D. Eisenhower was so pissed by the fact that Israel, France, and Great Britain had secretly planned to evict Egypt from the Suez Canal, and that Israel did not inform the United States of its intention, combined with ignoring American treaties not to go to war. This sparked a great deal of tension between the United States, Israel, and for that matter, Great Britain and France. The United States joined the Soviet Union. This is what gets me. Eisenhower was so pissed, he joined with the Soviet Union. And this is ironically, because the Soviets had just invaded Hungary in 1956. You had Soviet tanks rolling through the streets of Budapest. But anyway, he joined with the Soviets in a campaign to force Israel to withdraw. And this included a threat to discontinue all United States assistance, UN sanctions, and expulsion from the UN. And U.S. pressure resulted in an Israeli withdrawal from the areas it conquered without obtaining any concessions from the Egyptians. And you know what? Right then, right there, you had the seeds of the the Six-Day War in 1967 being sowed because Israel got not one single concession from the Egyptians. And now one reason...
Hold on. Let me interrupt you for just a minute real quick here. Somebody out there in the chat, Edge One, probably just transfer their information to the other, but they're trying to have a serious question. I did not open the line for them. I did let them post something. If you want to read what they're saying, if you want to comment. But it looks like we also have Boyd out there and I'm sure Boyd would have something useful to say, not some of the other stuff, if you want to go ahead and take another call. And in the meantime, like I said, you can take a look at the chat and see if you want to respond to that. Hey, Boyd, how you doing?
But, you know, we left there, and it's just not the same.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We did watch the girls or the women yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Because Caitlin Clark was playing.
Yeah.
Hey, that other team was dirty.
Hello.
One of them should have been ejected
from the
game.
What is this in reference to?
Fouling on Clark.
Yeah, the blatant foul on Caitlin Clark. I mean, even if it was inadvertent, she definitely went upside her head. She didn't even touch the ball. So that is supposed to be rules of flagrant foul.
Boy, are you
there? Touch the ball.
I'm not sure what's going on here.
Well, okay. I'll let you go and do whatever.
Okay.
All right. Talk to you. Bye bye.
Okay. Sounds like Boyd's on another call.
Wait a minute. Was Boyd just ejected from the call?
No. Sounds like there was multiple calls going on.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on out here.
That was a little strange. Okay.
Boyd is still open if they're out there.
Oh, okay, Boyd, you got something you want to say? Spit it out.
Actually, no, because I'm late getting to the party. And I apologize because if you did unmute me, I happen to be on the phone with my sister. So I am sorry.
What we were hearing.
And I wasn't muted on my end. I just didn't think of it. Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt the proceedings and party.
We're sorry for eavesdropping on you. I didn't mean to do that.
Okay.
We ain't the Stasi, man. We're not the East German Stasi. We don't do that around it.
Yeah, well, you know, my sister crippled herself up and broke her ankle. So, you know, we were talking about that and, you know, just
yeah, we
brother,
could tell
sister.
It was not part of this conversation.
I just can't see Joe out there.
Okay, so we've only got about 22 minutes left. So, okay, and I can go ahead and mute you if you don't have any other thing as far as the topic for tonight. That's quite all right, boy. Don't worry about that.
I can mute myself too, you know. So
okay, either way.
We don't have anything because I'll probably have to have some serious conversation with my two dogs. So I can mute myself.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if you can sort out the person called Edge One. They say they have a comment that is clean and brief.
Well,
and they'd like to talk
Edge
about their
One,
experience in the Middle East.
Well, yes, Edge One is saying that they are the 347 in the queue. But like I said, it was a number that I wasn't recognizing. And also, we got Joe on right now, so let's let Joe go. And, you know, I was asking Edge One just to post the comments out there so I wouldn't have to worry about the same person again because Edge joined shortly after the other ordeal that we just had with the two other callers. Two other callers probably by the name of Edge. Sorry, Edge,
well,
if I'm charging you improperly, I apologize.
Well,
but
everything,
Joe, are you
there? Everything that happens in Israel affects us. And that's the way it's going to be. It's going to affect the rest of the world. And whatever happens to Israel is going to affect the rest of the world. And that's the world stage. And that's the way it's going to be. And that's the way it is. So, and so say so God. So that's the way it's going to be. So, Sarge, everything that you said about Israel is pretty much true in the history of it. But, you know, you didn't give a theological perspective of it, but you gave a geography lesson.
History.
But as far as, you know, the history of Israel goes, that's basically what everything that Sarge broke down in the past couple of weeks is true. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, there's so many distortions about the historical record that I think we can at least eliminate a lot of the confusion about what went down if we just talk about what the historical record shows. Now, there's always room to argue a religious interpretation. historical record is reasonably clear, and we ought to be able to come to at least a broad consensus about the historical, what the historical record reveals, because so much commentary was made about it contemporaneously. So let's get that straight, and
yeah,
you know, we get that straight, then we kind of fill in the blanks on the other thing. Now,
yeah,
when I was saying earlier about Israel. And one of the reasons that Israel did give in to Eisenhower's demand was that was the insurance that Eisenhower gave to David Ben-Gurion, who was the Israeli prime minister. Now, before the Israelis evacuated Sharm el-Sheikh, which was a strategic point guarding the Straits of Tehran, which leads to the Red Sea and thence to the Indian Ocean, Israel got a promise from the United States that the United States would maintain the freedom of navigation in that waterway. And Washington sponsored a UN resolution that created the United Nations Emergency Force to deter future hostilities, assure freedom of navigation in the Straits of Tehran, and prevent Fedayeen raids from Gaza. Now, if you remember, the Straits of Tehran figured prominently in 1980 with Ronald Reagan, but that's another story. We can deal with that a little bit later. But the war did temporarily end the activities of the Fedayeen, but they were renewed a few years later by a loosely knit group organization that became known as, wait for it now, the Palestinian Liberation Organization.
Yellow.
So we can see how all of these historical currents and events are leading us up to what happened today. Okay? The Suez Canal was critical in starting momentum toward where we are today. And after the Suez War, none of the Arab governments recognized the state of Israel, even though Israel wanted to negotiate with their neighbors. Foreign Minister Golda Meir challenged Arab leaders to meet with David Ben-Gurion to negotiate a peace settlement. Nasser responded by saying Israel was trying to deceive the world, and he said his country would never recognize the Jewish state. They said the Arab state said they were not going to, they were refusing to negotiate a separate settlement for the refugees, the Palestinian refugees. That is such a big controversy today. They had an opportunity to negotiate some sort of resettlement effort for them, and they refused to do it. Nasser made clear that solving the refugee issue was not his concern. He said this: the danger of Israel lies in the very existence of Israel as it is in the present and in what she represents. And in the meantime, Syria used the Golan Heights, which towered 3,000 feet above the Galilee, to shell Israeli farms and villages with Soviet long-range artillery. Syria's attacks got more frequent in 1965 and 1966. Nasser's rhetoric became increasingly belligerent. He said, we shall not enter Palestine with its soil covered in sand. We shall enter with its soil saturated in blood. And a few months later, he said that the Arabs were aspiring to the full restoration of the rights of the Palestinians. So you can look at that as a veiled threat to destroy Israel. The immediate aim was to perfect Arab military might. The national aim was clearly, with anyone with eyes to see, the destruction of the state of Israel. I don't know any sovereign nation in the world that's going to let itself be destroyed when you can clearly see someone else is going to try to look to destroy it. I don't any, not any, even the ones I can't stand. I mean, there's no reason for a government to even exist. I wouldn't want to pay taxes to any government that wouldn't agree to defend its national sovereignty. That's almost like what the United States is like today, countenancing this invasion on the southern border. So go ahead, Sam.
Excuse me. This person, Edge, which is saying his name is Harrison, there's others that are wanting him to speak. They may be familiar with this person on some other show or something. So I am going to open the mic, but, you know, as I said, I'll mute it very quickly if we get into, if it's a repeat of what we've already had from two other callers. Edge,
good luck.
Harris.
Good luck.
Hello.
Well, I understand your reticence. I really do. But I thank you for taking the call. Now, I lived in the UK. I would go to Israel once or twice a year. Obviously, recently, it's been harder. But in Afghanistan, pre-1970, you see pictures of women. They're dressed normally, you know, they had rights. They had a life. What do you think will happen to Israel if Hamas takes over? If they're allowed to exist in any way, it will look much like the Afghanistan of today. There will be no women's rights. There will be no way for women to... I say to my wife all the time, you know, I love her. She's great at blowing me and making a pot roast. And sometimes she plays with my balls. But anyway.
Okay.
See? Okay, so the person who said they were going to take.
Well, I'm happy to know that he's got. I'm happy to know that he's got.
I was the one that said no.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to know he's got a good sex life with his wife. Good for you, sir. I'm really glad to hear that.
Once again, we have to pray for these poor souls out there.
Yeah,
and this is...
No, hey, man, they're getting it on. If they're happy and they're getting it on, I don't know if we need to pray for them.
No, we have to pray for their pervertedness. I don't care what they do in their own private life. Now, Suzette, are you happy?
Block Talk Radio is getting infected again. See, Block Talk Radio is getting infected again with these Tony Talk maggots. You know, and they made their debut on my show the other night. So they came, like 30 of them attacked me.
Yeah. It's just too bad that these poor souls don't have anything useful to do with their time. And that's what I pray for. It's like, this is all you have to, with everything going on in this crazy world, and your lack of any care for true, the only thing you obviously have your mind on is whatever. And it's just pathetic. It's too sad that's what these people are, and that's what I pray for.
Pedophiles.
I pray for their souls because they are lost souls.
Yeah, they're pedophiles. That's all. They're just little pedophiles. They're perverted, and they have to hurry up because they're in their grandmother's basement, and grandma's probably yelling at them, "Get off the internet already!" You know, they got no life. You know.
So anyway,
that's a good song.
Okay, we got about 12 minutes, and we're going to no more new calls. We're going to limit the calls today. We'll finish up with who's on the call right now.
Yeah. Well, even though they might want to troll us, this is still information for the punk faction of Blog Talk Radio, and you guys can be edified by it if you care to listen. Anyway, now we're moving on now from 1956 and the Suez Canal to what is directly responsible for the state of affairs today, and that is the Six-Day War, that remarkable week in world history that has really had everything riled up ever since. And I think that is key to understanding why we are where we are now. The Six-Day War is it. They're going to put the locus on everything. I'd have to say that this is it. The Six-Day War is the
shows you the power of God, that war right there, Sarge. It shows you how all those nations can surround Israel, outnumbered, outgunned, outtanked, outflanked, everything. And there's just stories that come from the desert that say dust storms will just pop up out of nowhere and they would shoot at Israeli tanks and nothing would happen. So there's stories like that. So it just shows you the power of God. And that's what happened. There was miracles that happened, you know, because they could not win. I mean, they have outnumbered Israel. They should have been annihilated, you know.
Yeah, and the few armies, few people, few nations of the world can survive multi-pronged attacks happening at once from technologically superior enemies. They had better equipment. They had heavier equipment. And somehow they still were able to prevail. It was really a remarkable thing. But they'd like to say that Israel made an unprovoked strike against their Arab neighbors in 1967, and that is pure balderdash. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. Here you got the Arabs threatening all of this stuff. Repeatedly, their leaders are talking about annihilating Israel. Rivers of blood, blood-soaked land, driving the Israeli invaders from the illegally occupied land, all this stuff. Leaders now, not just some religious leader
shouting on a street corner, but from the capitals of Damascus and Egypt and, you know, all these places didn't say anything. So Israel could see what was happening on their borders. Now, I would say that the only option they had is back. Remember, they had been even doubling their military output and their military support, especially Egypt. The supplies from the Soviet Union were really going off the chain. So Israel had to act with the element of surprise. Had it waited, they would have been at a potentially catastrophic disadvantage, much as they were in 1973 when Egypt and Syria came perilously close to finally defeating the nation of Israel, because they were taken by surprise, despite warnings. So you got NASA's verbal threats. Israel's under actual attack from terrorists. You got 35 raids in 1965 conducted against Israel. In 1966, the numbers went up to 41. In the first 4 months of 1967, 37 attacks were launched. Meanwhile, Syria is attacking Israeli kibbutzim from the Golan Heights, and that provoked a retaliatory strike in April of 1967, during which Israeli planes shot down six Syrian MiGs. And the Soviet Union, after that, they had been providing military and economic aid to both Syria and Egypt. They gave Damascus and Cairo information alleging a massive Israeli military buildup in preparation for an attack. And despite Israel denying it, Syria decided to invoke its defense treaty with Egypt. So on May 15th, Egyptian troops began moving into the Sinai and massing near the Israeli border. It was every bit as ominous as the German mobilization in August of 1914. No country can ignore that sort of massive military mobilization on its border. It was one of the things that led to World War I. It was one of the things that led to the Six-Day War. So you've got all these Egyptians massing in the Sinai Peninsula and on the Israeli border. On May 18th, Syrian troops prepared for battle along the Golan Heights. NASA ordered the United Nations Emergency Force, which was stationed in the Sinai in 1956, as we referenced earlier, to get the hell out on May 16th. And without bringing the matter to the attention of the General Assembly, as his predecessor had promised, Secretary General Yutong complied with the demand. He just decided that, okay, he just says to get out. Rather than me bringing this back up with the UN General Assembly for reconsideration, I'm just going to go along with it. And he did. And after the United Nations Emergency Force withdrew, the voice of the Arabs said this, get a load of this. As of today, there no longer exists an international emergency force to protect Israel. We shall exercise patience no more. We shall not complain any more to the United Nations about Israel. The sole method we shall apply against Israel is total war, which will result in the extermination of Zionist existence. And those sentiments were echoed by the Syrian defense minister, Hafez Assad. Our forces are now entirely ready, not only to repulse the aggression, but also to initiate the act of liberation itself and to explode Zionist presence in the Arab homeland. The Syrian army, with its finger on the trigger, is united. I, as a military man, believe that the time has come to enter into a battle of annihilation. On May 22nd, Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran to all Israeli shippings and all ships bound for Eilat. This blockade cut off Israel's only supply route with Asia and stopped the flow of oil from its major supplier, Iran. The following day, Johnson declared the blockade illegal and tried unsuccessfully to organize an international flotilla to test it. Nasser was fully aware of what he was doing to force Israel's hand. The day after the blockade was set up, this is what he said. Another quote, Jews threaten to make war. I replied, welcome. We are ready for war. Nasser challenged Israel to fight daily. Another quote, our basic objective will be the destruction of Israel. The Arab people want to fight. He said that on May 27th. The next day, he said this, we will not accept any coexistence with Israel. Today the issue is not the establishment of peace between the Arab states and Israel. The war with Israel has been in effect since 1948. King Hussein of Jordan signed a defense pact with Egypt on May 30th. Nasser then said publicly, he said all these things publicly, the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon are poised on the borders of Israel. To face the challenge, while standing behind us are the armies of Iraq, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, and the whole Arab nation. This act will astound the world. Today they will know that the Arabs are arranged for battle and that the critical hour has arrived. We have reached the stage of serious action and not declarations. Now, President Abdul Rahman Arif of Iraq joined in by saying, the existence of Israel is an error which must be rectified. This is our opportunity to wipe out the ignominy that has been with us since 1948. Our goal is clear, to wipe Israel off the map. On June 4th, Iraq joined the military alliance with Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. Now, the Arab rhetoric was matched by mobilizing Arab forces, 25,000 troops, nearly half, and 250,000, rather, troops, nearly half in Sinai, more than 2,000 tanks and 700 aircraft ring Israel. Hell, that's comparable to the number of tanks that the Germans deployed in the Battle of Kursk. Now, by this time, Israeli forces have been on alert for 3 weeks. The country couldn't stay fully mobilized indefinitely, nor could allow its sea lane through the Gulf of Aqaba to be interdicted. Israel's best and only real option was to strike first. And on June 5th,
okay, excuse me.
7th, they gave the order.
Yeah, excuse me for a quick second, Sarge. Looks like we have Joe from Montana out there in the queue. I'm trusting that no one's playing any more games out there. But who knows? And also, just to let everybody know, we got just a little bit over 2 minutes. Well, we're going to run over a few minutes until we have a good closing spot. I'm not planning on going the whole next hour. But if you're listening via the Internet and you want to continue, go ahead and call in. And again, I see Joe from Montana out here, so I want to go ahead and let him chime in. But we can go over a little bit since we obviously lost some time out there because of the other stuff. And also I'd like to be able to, you know, at a good closing point on the discussion. So, okay, Joe.
Hello,
Sally.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. I think you missed all the fun earlier.
What happened earlier?
Oh, just a couple of perverts, that's all.
No.
Yeah.
I have one question for Sarge. I don't know how long you were talking because I just got here a few minutes ago. Sarge, the land that Israel now possesses, was that given to them by the United Nations? And if so, or who gave it to them, or how do they possess it? Is it legitimately theirs? And if it is it considered not legitimate by the Arab nations?
The pre-1967 borders were given to them by the United Nations mandate, which was voted on by a two-thirds vote that gave them control of the partition established by the UN mandate. So the pre-67 borders were definitely that. Now, the post-1967 borders were established by Israel's legitimate participation in a defensive war, and for the most part was territory that most people from a military and tactical point of view agree is necessary to assure Israel's national security, given the fact that the people bordering them have refused to recognize them as a legitimate state. So you got the two-pronged thing. You got the fact that the borders were created by the United Nations mandate that the British handed over to the United Nations and the conquest of that territory in what is considered a legitimate defensive war in 1967 when they got the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Gaza and Jerusalem.
So the Jewish state is legitimately theirs because they won it in a post-1966 or 1967 war. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and on the laws of international warfare, territory seized for the purpose of securing your national position in a legitimate war, defensive or offensive, is considered within the boundaries of international law. That doesn't mean it's not subject to negotiation, but it doesn't mean that you don't have a right to it simply because you didn't own it before the war started.
All right. So if they didn't own that particular piece of land, which is now Israel, but they fought for it and won it and was recognized by the United Nations internationally, in some circles, it's considered a legitimate nation and their legitimate land. But then I presume that the Arab states surrounding Israel do not consider that a legitimate reason for their being there. And therefore, I presume that's the reason why they want to get rid of Israel at all costs.
That pretty much sums it up. And that's why I say the ultimate arbiter of matters when you cannot reach a negotiation is military might. That's the ultimate arbiter. When people decide to stop talking with each other, and that's just the way things are. That's the way things are always going to be. It was that way with us in Mexico. Couldn't reach an agreement.
Well,
got to fight.
Yeah, but if the seems to me that the Jews and the Arabs, if they coexisted, maybe not peacefully, but for a few hundred years, ever since biblical times. So why the disagreement over their land in 1967?
Well, you missed it in me saying this earlier, but I did go into that earlier on in the show. I was discussing as to how the British were giving contradictory assurances to the key players in the deal when they sought to get the assistance of the Arabs and the Bedouins in their war against the Ottoman Empire, so they could open up the second front to break the stalemate on the Western Front by invading the Dardanelles through Gallipoli, which led to the campaign in Palestine that liberated Jerusalem and got that place under British control. They were making promises all over the place, to the one set of promises to the Arabs, another set of promises to the Jews and the Zionists, another set of promises and assurances to the international community. All three of these were not going to be reconciled, and in fact, never were.
Okay, but again, if the Jews and the Arabs coexisted during biblical times, right, 2,000 years ago, then why the arguments over why they exist now? I know the British, from what you're saying, seems to have taken over that area and made promises to three different factions, but still, regardless of...
When did they exist during biblical times? Coexist. What are you talking about? They didn't exist. Coexist.
Well, actually,
there was always,
actually, Joe, like I was saying earlier, Joe, Joe Montana missed it. I was speaking of how oftentimes high Arab leaders, like the Sharif of Mecca, like King Faisal, who was instrumental in the Egyptian assistance with the British to defeat the Ottoman Empire, spoke favorably of the Zionists and the enterprise and productivity that they brought to the land. They were actually favorable to the Zionists and the Jewish presence in the region because it brought enterprise and prosperity, a higher standard of living, and improved health conditions to the Arabs who flocked into those regions as a result of the Zionist enterprises. But the problem was this: with the creation of a Jewish state, they simply were not willing to countenance that. That for them was a bridge too far.
So the Jews were just a disparate group of people like gypsies. And then when they wanted to solidify as the Jewish state, that caused the problems, presumably because they were going to, not recognize the Arabs, the Palestinians?
Just simply the very fact of a religion posing any sort of a challenge to Islam. They pretty much feel the same way about Christians.
That land wasn't inhabited but when the Jews were freed from the Egyptians, when Moses freed the Jews from the Egyptians, that land was not occupied by anybody. God gave that land to Abraham.
You got to remember, Joe Montana, that 60% of the Israeli nation was arid desert that was given to them by the partition. 60% of it was the Negev. Okay, that's in southern Israel. Most of the productive land was given to the Arabs. At the time of the partition in 1948.
Oh, I'm talking about, we're talking 4,000 years ago now. We're going back 4,000 years, 1948.
I understand that you are, but I'm just saying that even more recently, because like I said, like you were saying, the Arabs and the Hebrews lived in relative harmony with some, but for the most part, they were able to coexist with each other. But remember, here's the thing, though, Joe. They were coexisting in a region that was always governed by another greater empire, whether it was the Persians, whether it was the Romans, whether it was the Ottomans.
The Jews were enslaved. The Hebrews were enslaved by the Egyptians. That's where I'm talking about, that time frame.
Well, not all of them were.
Yes, they were. Not all of them. Many of them were.
Yeah, most of them were, but not all of them. There was always a Jewish presence aside from the enslaved Jews that goes back to that time.
Egypt ruled that area. How could that be? If they caught a Jew that was free, they would enslave them. All Jews were enslaved for a long time by the pharaohs. Yeah, if they caught a Jew being free, they would have snatched them up. Get over here. And like, you know, they were enslaved for a long time until Moses freed them.
Well, it's like anything that a government does. They're never successful with 100% of anybody. And even the Egyptians weren't successful 100% of the time at rounding up every Jew they chose to enslave.
I'll concede that every single one was not in chains, but they weren't a people. They didn't have a government. You know, Egypt pharaohs ruled that whole region for 2,000 years?
We gotta make sure we don't talk over each other because we can't quite hear everything. Who's going to talk next here? Joe from Montana, was there anything else you wanted to add? I'm kind of trying to keep that.
In that land where the Jews and the Arabs did coexist, how many Jews compared to how many Arabs? Let's say there was a population of about 10,000. What percentage were Jews? What percentage would be Arabs?
Well, again, it depends on what region you're talking about. Jews are always a minority overall, but in certain regions they were the majority. That's why I'm really concentrating my discussion on the era beginning with the Ottoman Empire in the 14th century, because they kept very good census records. We have very accurate census records because the Ottomans invited Jews because of the nature of their ability to do enterprise and build and create things. The Ottomans, even though they were Muslims, they invited the Jews in the region because they would expand the economy and they would pay the jizya tax.
Hang on a second. Joe is correct. The Jews, they exist. They did coexist with the Palestinian people before the advent of Zionism and Arab nationalism.
Absolutely. And that was mainly starting in the 14th century, which was a lot more recent than ancient Egyptian times. But hang on.
You didn't let me finish. But the Palestinians weren't like one group of people. They were 60 different tribes of kings, the Jordanians, if they're Beirut. You know, they weren't like one people, you know?
Yes, exactly. They didn't assume this common Palestinian identity until after Israel won its independence in 1948.
Exactly.
Like you said, they were a disparate bunch of tribal people who just happened to live in the same region. Most definitely. See, that's why we need to get this history straight. Because nowadays you got people on both sides of the issue, but especially those who claim they are pro-Palestinian who give you a completely distorted or absolutely incomplete view of history, the actual history that occurred. Because remember, the Ottoman Empire encouraged Jews to settle there because they knew the Jews could bring a standard of living and economy and tax base that they didn't have with just the Arabs and the Bedouins.
Sarge, in 1948, did the Jews rise up because of oppression and as a result sought to found their state in that same area which they existed for centuries? Is that the reason?
Well, that's a little bit of a wild oversimplification. Well, I wouldn't say wild, but...
Well, what about the Moabites, Sarge? What about the Moabites?
Well, again, you're going back a little further than I'm dealing with. The reason I'm doing this is because I really am looking at the genesis of I'm going 500 years to now.
Okay, then. All right, all right. Because the outbreak of famine in Judea precipitated the Jewish families at that time to leave ancestral Israelite homeland.
Yes, you had ebbs and tides of Jewish population. The migration did carry them to and fro the region. The numbers were not constant. The numbers started being constant around the time after the destruction of the Second Temple when the Ottomans took control in the 14th century.
Okay,
that's
so you're only going 500 years.
Stabilized.
Okay, I got you then. You were confusing me.
That's why I'm doing
it that way
because you had all this ebb and flow prior to that. But remember, that region was always under the control of a great empire, Egypt. Then you had the Persian Empire. Then you had the Roman Empire. Then you had the Ottoman Empire. Then the British had it for only 31 years.
Well, wait a minute. You're missing. Yeah, but hang on. You're missing the tribes of Jacob, and you're missing some of that time in between there. You know.
Well, Israel, the Judea and Israel were two separate, like city states, I guess you might say, like with Greece, and they were like two separate kingdoms, but they were sort of united in their Hebrew identity and the Judaic identity.
What was the motivation for them in 1948 to rise up to seek their own state?
Well, they had it in 1948. The Genesis started in 1890, Joe, when the Zionist movement formally when the Zionist movement formally met in Basel, Switzerland, to start implementing plans for a Jewish state in Palestine. That's the genesis of what you're speaking of. In the 1890s. And it was from then to 1948, compelled by the British with the Balfour Declaration and the Sykes-Picot Agreement, enabled the environment to allow the Jews to begin their claim for an Arab state, for an Israeli state.
That's probably the answer.
Yeah, but since the 7th century, as Arabs conquered vast lands in the expansion from Mecca in Saudi Arabia to the whole Middle East and the Mediterranean, countries in North Africa, a doctrine was developed, Sarge, which basic tenet was, and still is today, lands conquered by Muslims belong to Ummah and the Islamic community and cannot be surrendered never. That's what the battle is all about, technically.
Oh, yeah.
The non-Muslim residents in these lands can, at best, achieve the status of nothing, basically, because they can't stand them. They can't stand Jews and Christians. But if you go before that time, before the Arab conquest, the Jews owned that land. The Jews conquered that land. That was given to them by, to Abraham, to Jacob, David, to Solomon. So that was all the Jewish land. But Arabs can't recognize that. They will not recognize that part of history.
And the
Ottomans were definitely Muslim.
The Muslims also still claim Spain as their territory.
I know. They do.
Well, good for them.
Good luck with it.
Just because
when you got the military might, maybe they'll take it back.
Because they had conquered it at one time.
I know. Well, if they ever get the military wherewithal, perhaps they will conquer it back. It's like I say, when you stop talking, the fighting starts.
And the other comment I'd like to make on this was the British fucked up that part of the world with the Balfour Agreement because the Arabs were a tribal people. And the thing is that when Britain broke up the Middle East into what we see today, into the nations that are there, they didn't care what the tribes were in that area. Hell, there's some that are, excuse me, that have three or four distinct Arab tribes in it. And the tribes never fully got along with each other anyway.
Yeah,
and if Britain had been smart, they would have broke it up, you know, to a point where the tribes were the majority in any one country. And they would have their lands.
Yeah.
See, the doctrine that you're talking about, boy, see, the Muslims, they have this doctrine. It's called, I can't pronounce it, the Dhimmis or something, Dhimmis. And what
Dhimmis.
That word says is that Dhimmis. Well, they have no inherent human rights. That's what the Muslim doctrine is. They are given limited rights by the Muslim rulers at the ruler's discretion, and these rights can be taken away at any time and place. This doctrine is what is taught to Islamic children across the world, and it's taught to kids from a young age, and it's difficult to erase that doctrine from because it's embedded into them, and that's the Hamas doctrine.
Well, you ought to hear some of the hadith, which are interpretations of the Quran. You ought to hear some of the hadith that they say about the Jews. They just ain't putting up with no Jews. I mean, if you take the hadith literally, and you're supposed to if you're a Muslim, you are simply not supposed to tolerate the Jews as having any sort of ascendancy in any area that is part of Dar es Salaam.
Us too. Us too. We're the infidel. We're worthy of death. We're either be converted and to be tricked to be converted or killed. That's what they believe. They live in this country. They live in America even, you know?
Well, you can look at some of the hadith about that. The Surah 288, and it says this, our hearts are covered. Nay, Allah has cursed them on account of their unbelief. So little it is that they believe. Whoever is the enemy of Allah and his angels and his apostles and Jibreel and Mikael, so surely Allah is the enemy of the unbelievers. I mean, they got all kind of surahs and hadiths about this stuff.
Crazy.
Now tell me, I mean, you know about you? I know you've heard one of the most famous ones about the Jew hiding behind the tree. If you find the Jew hiding behind the tree, come and kill him.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I've heard of so much crap. The Muslim, the Quran is the biggest fairy tale book and most violent book that's ever been written in any religion.
Well, that's one of the things. Hitler said he liked about. He said he thought Islam was a very warlike religion that led to a warlike people. He didn't like Christianity because they thought it was too passive, especially in the New Testament. But he said he liked the idea of Islamic warriors prepared to die for their religion. He said he could align it very nicely with the goals of National Socialism.
Well, we know how he used them, too, on the front line.
Yep.
He made that clear. I mean, you read many of his discussions with many of his mid and high-ranking ministers. He regularly said that he wished he could find a way to harness the fervor of the Muslims in the and align it with the goals of National Socialism.
Okay. Well, how do we want to kind of wrap up? Do you want to just each person kind of give a few thoughts as we close out the show, or is there a little bit more that you want to kind of go over real quick, Thor?
Well, there's a little bit more I want to go over with regard to the Six-Day War and its aftermath, but clearly we don't have enough time for that. So I guess each person can, you know, kind of put in their commentary.
Oh, about how much? About how much time you think it would take for you to go over that?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe about was it 9:20 now? Maybe about 8 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. Why don't we go ahead and finish it? I would like to go ahead and let you finish that presentation. Then we'll do a quick roundtable of what people are thinking in general, and then we'll wrap it up for tonight.
Oh, okay.
Excellent discussion. With the exception of those other couple of calls, this has been an excellent discussion. This is what I was wanting for the whole discussion, not the other crapola, but that's another story. And anyway, from there, go ahead, Sarge.
Okay. Well, anyway, I left off with the discussion about 250,000 Arab troops, nearly half of them on the Sinai Desert and from Egypt, with Arab armies that were poised to attack from Egypt with 2,000 tanks. Good Lord. Like I said, that's comparable to the Battle of Kursk. And 700 aircraft ring to strike Israel. So, and they couldn't keep their forces on alert forever because most of the Israelis are reservists. They have civilian occupations. They have jobs. They have homes they got to take care of. Most of the Israeli army is a reserve army. They can't keep them mobilized indefinitely. They had to have their sea lanes through the Gulf of Aqaba to be opened, so they had to strike first. And on June 5th, 1967, they did exactly that. And they struck first in one of the most effective examples of combined armed operations, and ironically, blitzkrieg, the world has ever seen since World War II. The Israelis just did an incredible job of defeating simultaneously five Arab armies. The United States had given Israel assurances that it would recognize the Israelis' right of access to the Straits of Tehran. Again, that's in southern Israel. It leads to the Gulf of Eilat and leads out to the Red Sea and from there to the Indian Ocean. It is a crucial maritime navigable waterway. And in 57, the UN, 17 of the greatest maritime powers declared that Israel had a right to transit the Straits of Tehran. And they said the blockade violated the International Convention on Territorial Sea and Contiguous Zones, which was adopted by the Conference on the Law of the Sea on April 27, 1958. They said that closing it was a legitimate cause of war, and Israeli's attack was a reaction to Egypt's first strike in closing the straits. And the United States tried to prevent the war through negotiations, but it couldn't persuade Nasser or the other Arab states to stop their belligerence and their actions, their belligerent statements and their belligerent protocol. And Israel, Johnson told Israel before the war that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. Then when the war began, the State Department said our position is neutral in thought, word, and deed. So, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouth. But meanwhile, the Arabs were falsely accusing the United States of airlifting supplies to Israel. Johnson imposed an arms embargo on the entire region. France also embargoed arms to Israel. So the United States was not giving weapons and supplies to Israel during the period of the hostility. That is simply not true. But the Soviets were giving massive amounts of arms to the armies of Kuwait, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. And the Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian fronts were all getting Soviet equipment and supplies. And besides not helping the Israelis in the war, the United States and Israel actually came into direct military conflict, mainly, probably, I do believe, errors, miscommunication, and the fog of war. I do believe, now that I've really studied it thoroughly, the attack on the Liberty was one of those fog of war things that happens, given simultaneous things going on with technology available in 1967 that could lead to misinterpretation. So I don't think the Israelis deliberately attacked the Liberty. I think they thought it might have been an Egyptian warship that was shelling Israeli troops in El Arish. And the United States had announced they didn't have any naval forces within hundreds of miles of the battlefront, even though the Liberty was under the control of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, and they weren't communicating with the Sixth Fleet. That probably had a lot to do with it. And they were monitoring the fighting in Israel. As a result of communication failures, where messages directing the ship not to go within 100 miles were not received by the Liberty, according to the ship's log, sailed within 14 miles off the Sinai coast. The Israelis thought this ship was shelling its soldiers, and they attacked it with warplanes and torpedo boats, and they killed 34 United States sailors and wounded 171. So you had that going on there, too. I do think it was fog of war more than anything else, miscommunication and technological inadequacies in 1967. And so the Israelis went on to capture Jerusalem. You know, that was, again, another, again, all this shit happened in 6 days. And the idea that the Israel expelled Arab villagers from the West Bank and prevented them from coming back, that's really another big grievous a calumny against Israel. It just did not happen that way. When Jordan launched the attack on June 5th, 325,000 Palestinians living in the West Bank fled. They were Jordanian citizens who moved from one part of what they thought was their country to another, and mainly they did it because they didn't want to get caught in the crossfire of a war. Now, and a Palestinian refugee who was an administrator in the United Nations Relief Welfare Agency camp in Jericho said Arab politicians had spread rumors in the camp. And it's a quote from the guy. They said all the young people would be killed. People heard on the radio that this is not the end, only the beginning. So they think maybe it will be a long war, and they want to be in Jordan during the duration of the war. Now, some Palestinians who left preferred to live in an Arab state rather than under Israeli military rule. Members of the different PLO factions fled to avoid being captured by the Israelis. Anils Goran Gusing, the person appointed by the UN Secretary General to investigate the situation, found that Arabs also feared they would no longer be able to receive money from family members who were working abroad. So Israeli forces did order some of Palestinian families to move for strategic and security reasons. I don't know why anybody would be surprised by that. In many cases, they were allowed to return in a few days. In others, the Israelis resettled them elsewhere. And following the war, Israel ruled more than 750,000 Palestinians, most of whom were clearly hostile to the Israeli government. But despite that, more than 9,000 Palestinian families were reunited in 1967. Ultimately, more than 60,000 Palestinians were allowed to return to those regions under the governmental control of Israel. So that's kind of got us through the Six-Day War now. And next up would be the War of Attrition from 1967 to 1970 and the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and that's a whole nother phase of the conflict. But the 67 Six-Day War got us all the ingredients to create this toxic stew that we're living with now.
Interesting. What a tangled web or pot of whatever we make. So been just, it's interesting in general when it comes to how the human race is. We are truly the lowest life form on this planet as far as I'm concerned. And that was before, I already thought that before the craziness of tonight. But it really, it's sick how human nature is. It's pretty disgusting when it comes to it. And then when you think of what these people are doing to us today, the, you know, trying to take away all of rice, trying to destroy our country, letting this influx of all these invaders coming in who, you know, are causing harm across the board. It's really, it's a sad state of affairs, and it's kind of like, dear Lord, help us, and when is it going to come to an end? When will we be saved from this craziness of the evilness of people? It's a sad situation. I don't know. But anyway, excellent discussion, and we will have another show on this. It won't be the very next one, but we will continue on this because it's really important that people have a little bit more understanding of what's happening around the world. And I know that I wasn't really taught anything in public education in reference to this. The only thing I ever saw or really heard about the Middle East is what little bit I saw on the news, and that was it. So it's important. Let's go ahead and take a quick roundtable. Thank you so much, Sarge, for doing this. I think it's been excellent. Joe, any last thoughts or comments?
Which Joe?
Joe Montana. Joe from Montana dropped off. I think it got too noisy for him.
Okay. All right. No, I'm just saying interesting. I think pretty much voiced it all. If you got anybody wants to carry over and talk about this more, a little bit more, touch base on some other things, I'm going to do a show after you, Sally. Other than that, yeah, it was a good production. Obviously, Sarge looked into a lot of stuff and read a lot of stuff or studied a lot of stuff for some time point in his life to know this, because the average American does not know this. And we go by the media.
Absolutely.
And that is so stupid and asinine to be wanting to fight over something so very important. Or if it's not important, if fight at all, well, based upon very little knowledge or belief. So just do your homework. That's all I recommend.
Yeah, and don't depend on what the news media tells you. Assume that the news media is the mainstream media is totally fake news, and go do your own homework. Never trust what they say. If by now anybody is still truly listening to them, whatever, I guess you'll just drink any Kool-Aid they serve you. So try to be more informed and educated. Go challenge critical thinking. Right. Challenge what they're saying. So, okay. Boyd, you still there? Any last words you'd like to share?
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that the Arabs are a tribal people. And those tribes have been fighting each other for thousands of years. The only thing right now that's keeping these tribes from killing each other is their uniform hatred of Jews or infidels, you know. No matter whether or not they're getting assistance from them or not, they want to kill them. That's it. And, you know, if for some reason the Arabs would annihilate all of the Jews and everything there in Israel and wipe Israel completely off the map, then the war in the Middle East will continue because they have to continue the war. Muslims are warlike. They're, you know, their prophet, Mohammed, was a criminal from the very get-go. And, you know, he was just like a frickin' mob boss, I guess you could say. And he went out and conquered all of the Arabs who weren't Muslims and made them all become Muslims. And the way that goes. So, anyway, you know, it'd be fun to see them all get over killing the Jews and go back to killing each other. I mean, the Iran-Iraq war, you know, was fought between two Arab nations and two Arab tribes and two Muslim religions. And it was at a time when everything in Israel and everything was reasonably at peace.
But at the same time, look at what we have done, and when it comes to promoting wars. I mean, Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, he loves war because I guess he makes a lot of money on it in his trading or whatever, his special interest, his military, whatever. But you think of, you know, the human creature, whatever you want to call these humans, they love the war. The sickness of it, they love war, unfortunately. I mean, that's the way I kind of see it. There's not. Let's have a war whether we need one or not. and then you go and you want to know why the culture has gone down to whatever, and how you think you can blend all these different cultures and live happily ever after, as we've attempted to be some kind of melting pot in this country. And then you just see the evilness of people who have their own ideals and their own ideology, whatever you want to call it, religion or ideology.
Yeah.
And, you know, go ahead and kill somebody. What the heck? Let's have a war just for the fun of it. And, of course, all the other insanity of war when it comes to the economy and population control. But, yeah, go ahead.
And all of those wars and everything, it doesn't matter who, what, when, where, or why. They're having a war.
Yeah.
But the international military industrial complex loves it.
Absolutely. Which is sick. Sick, sick, sick. Okay. Sarge, I'll wrap up and, you know, what people preview, a teaser for what we'll talk about on the next show we do on the Middle East.
Well, I think what we'll be doing in the next go-around, and like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity to share what I know about this with people, hear their input on it, and, you know, because, I mean, I'm not the final, so I'm by no means am I the final authority on this. There's a lot of stuff I missed. There's a lot of stuff I've covered, and there's a lot more to say about it than what I've said. It's one of the most complicated human interactions on the planet. But I really do welcome the opportunity to be able to share what I know about people to maybe get people interested in looking, doing their own research on what happened, adding their own input on it so more people will have a better understanding. And if we do another show on this, it will be, we'll go over the War of Attrition and the 1977 Yom Kippur War, the modifications of the borders that ensued from that. And then we'll probably be talking about Israel and its incursions into Lebanon and the subsequent wave of terrorist activity that followed from that. So hopefully we'll be able to get through that by then. And we might also touch on the United Nations role in all of this. And, of course, the refugee situation, which is a big thorn under the saddle in all of this.
And very relevant to the whole discussion. Absolutely.
Very much so.
So, absolutely. excuse me again. Anyway, I think it was a great show, despite a few stupid interruptions, as some people out there in the chat want to call it color. Making it colorful. Well, sorry, folks, I don't want a colorful show. So, anyway, well, just lessons learned on the perverts out there. But we did cover a lot of good information, and we're not going to waste that. That's information, and we will continue this discussion. And as a reminder, no show next week. I will be in North Carolina, or either just coming back from North. Anyway, I got a crazy schedule next week. I will be in North Carolina some next week, and then when I get back, we'll resume the shows, and we will continue on. And dear Lord, help us all. Say a prayer for all of the individuals who need it out there, and keep engaged. We still got to fight it. We will work around those people, and we will continue on. And dear Lord, help us. Dear Lord, help us, and may God.
Well, let's at least try to avoid normalizing mental illness. What do you say to that?
Yes, do not normalize mental illness and this other nutsiness of what they're trying to do to the children and the society at large. It's just it's all pretty sick, with an evil intent at the bottom of it all.
Precisely.
So, okay, Joe, you want to let everybody know how to jump on your show for anybody who might be new listening?
Oh, yeah, about 15 minutes. Go to blogtalkradio.com/Joseph Gibson, 657-383-0616. And I think I might play a little something about George Washington tonight, because, you know, we definitely need to get back to the foundations of America.
Amen. That would be good, huh? Washington, he was the father of our country, and that would be good to listen to. So thank you again, everyone. Please be engaged. Be good to each other. And say a prayer for our country. I love my country. It's my government I'm afraid of. Have a good night, and God bless America.